will tell them. Bella Ciao, Bella Ciao, Bella Ciao, 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 that our sunlight.
This week in Radical History is dedicated to all my sisters and brothers who were with me illegally detained and abused while in custody, and to all the radicals on the streets during this past week's RNC in St. Paul, Minnesota.
It's been just a few minutes since we were able to get away from the tear gas, which was a task in and of itself. I can say getting tear gassed is not fun, but even worse than that is being trapped. I don't know what was happening at the front of the line where the tear gas first went off, but it may be melodramatic, but that didn't feel it. Being an American.
Take what's there. Cause finally the tables are starting to turn. Talking about the revolution.
This week in Radical History for the week starting September 8th. Inspiration came from the Slingshot Organizer, some more radical historical info came from the Daily Bleed website, and one audio segment was borrowed from the Radio Roots crew at WBAI in New York.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes. Hey!
This week in Radical History for September 8th, 1883, Sitting Bull, Tatanka Ayotek, whose position was being bypassed by the U.S. authorities because he firmly stood against the robbery of his native people, spoke at the celebration of the driving of the last stake in the Northern Pacific Railroad joining with the transcontinental system. He delivered the speech in his Sioux language, departing from the speech originally prepared with an army translator. Denouncing U.S. government, settlers, and army, the listeners thought he was delivering a speech of welcome and praise. While giving his speech, Sitting Bull would pause for applause, periodically bow, smile, and continue insulting and making asses of the audience and U.S. authorities as the translator delivered the original address. Also on September 8, 1971, the Attica prison riot occurred at the correction facilities in Attica, New York. The riot was based upon prisoners' demand for better living conditions. On September 13th, tear gas was dropped into the yard, and New York State Police state troopers opened fire nonstop for 2 minutes into the smoke. Among the weapons used by the troopers were shotguns, which led to the wounding and killing of hostages and inmates who were not resisting. After the prison was retaken, officers for a week beat and mistreated the prisoners in Attica. Nah, never happens in prisons. Besides, we are so much better these days. Here's a very short interview of abuses suffered at the RNC in St. Paul, Ramsey County Jail. Last week, September 2nd, 2008.
So that we could receive food in Ramsey County Jail because we hadn't been provided food. 6 or 7 officers came into my cell, took one officer punched me in the face right here where you see this bruise, and I fell to the ground, unconscious, and the officer grabbed me by the head, slammed my head on the ground, and reawoke me out of to consciousness. And I was bleeding everywhere. They dragged me to another detaining cell. They put a bag over my head that had a gag on it. There was a point where I did it. Went without food for about 12 hours. I had been coughing up blood and vomiting, and I fainted once because I wasn't receiving any food, and I was like dry heaving and vomiting. And one officer said that I was being bulimic. I was being called gay by multiple officers, called the princess. When they had this bag around my head while I was being tortured, I was concussed, and later I was in a holding cell in Regent's Hospital, and I had thrown up in the bag that was around my head, and I was begging them to take it off of my face, and they would not take the bag off of my head.
Also on September 8th, 1974, President Gerald Ford pardons the trickster, beloved comrade Tricky Dick Nixon, for any crimes he committed or may have committed while president, starting a long line of pardoning to cover up friends' illegal activities, like Ollie North, for example, and wait for this year's get-out-of-jail-free Christmas gifts from the Bush administration to his co-conspirators. More prisoner news. In 1976, prisoners take over three of the four wings of the Hull Prison in England, including Jack Prescott, in prison for his activities with the anarchist Angry Brigade. Their protests include conditions in a prison workshop where furniture is made for prisons in Iran. On this date 3 years later, 3,000 unarmed demonstrators would be killed by the CIA-sponsored Shah of Iran's death squads. This week in Radical History for September 9th, 1590, Rebecca Limp, a wife of an accountant and mother of six, is burned at the stake as a witch in Germany. She is tortured 5 times before confessing of her crimes. When she attempted to poison herself to avoid more torture, the lawyer added the charge of attempted suicide to her witchcraft charges. Historians estimated that as many as 9 million European women were killed as witches in the 14th, 15th, and 16th centuries by the good old God-fearing Christians. Also on September 9th, 1869, I despise you. I despise your order, your laws, your force-propped authority. Hang me for it. Louis Ling's last words as he addressed the court during the Haymarket trial. Ling was one of the 8 men accused of the bombing of the notorious Haymarket riot. He was found guilty along with 4 others, sentenced to be hung. Ling, however, had a dynamite cap smuggled into his cell, detonated in his mouth, cheating the state out of its glory. All the anarchists, by the way, hung and killed by the state for the Haymarket riots, were pardoned after their deaths, as the real evidence was shown as involvement by the police in the Haymarket bombing itself. Also on this date in 1917, anarchist Antonio Fornasier is killed by Milwaukee police for heckling a priest. His comrade, Augusta Marlini, wounded on the same occasion, dies 5 days later. 10 men and women are arrested for inciting a riot, later linked to a November 24th bomb explosion that occurred while they were still imprisoned. Despite the fact that they were in jail at the time, each was found guilty and sentenced between 11 to 25 years of imprisonment. Then, as in today, from last week's RNC in St. Paul, Minnesota, this short outtake.
2007, we had a critical mass bike ride where 19 people were charged with these probable cause riot charges. Only 5 people, of course, were ever formally charged with anything. A case that went to trial, actually a person with the RNC welcoming committee, was acquitted because video evidence showed the officers lying. Another client of mine charged with various gross misdemeanors. Cases were dismissed because the video showed officers were lying.
2 more items for September 9th, 1968. In a press conference, Mayor Daley makes his now famous slip of the tongue. The policeman isn't there to create disorder. The policeman is there to preserve disorder. Lastly, on that date in 2002, that commie-loving Nelson Mandela dares to call the United States a threat to world peace. He is finally taken off the terrorism watch list by the United States government last month on his 90th birthday. Happy birthday, Mandela. Now that you're a 90, you're no longer a terrorist threat to the United States. This week in Radical History for September 10th, 1901, feminist and anarchist Emma Goldman arrested in an alleged link to President McKinley's assassination. In this atmosphere of intense anti-anarchist hysteria, Emma goes into temporary hiding. Then, as in today, here's a short outtake from St. Paul last week.
About a year ago, we started an investigation into the RNC Welcoming Committee. That's a local anarchist group, and we utilized a couple of undercover officers and some informants, and worked hand-in-hand with some FBI sources as well. And it was clear that from the beginning, the Welcoming Committee was a group of anarchists who were interested in shutting down the convention through whatever means would be necessary. The blockades was their primary tactic, but property damage was always on the table because, you know, this particular group believes that property damage is not a crime, that they think it's appropriate considering the oppression of government on society, and we've studied their culture. And
last comment, is Monica afraid right now? Is she sorry she was involved with organizing protests around the Republican National Convention?
Absolutely not. She's going to continue her work because, I mean, the work she is doing is far more important than, you know, the legal consequences, whatever they may be. So, no, she's confident, she's strong, she's experienced. While this is an outrageous violation of people's rights, outrageous imposition on people's lives, it's nevertheless something which is not entirely unexpected, and she knew that going in.
When 8 people that I know and have been working with for the last year are being charged with conspiracy and acts of terrorism, silence is not acceptable. There are no terrorists on this stage There are no terrorists in the Ramsey County Jail. There isn't one of us. There isn't eight of us. We are all the welcoming committee, and we stand together today.
Lastly, for September 10, 1945, Robert Goddard, father of American rocketry, dies. Found at his desk, pen in his hand, his heart seized up like a rusty chainsaw. The last entry in his diary scrawled, quote, "If you were to take the Nagasaki bomb and put it on my rocket, my God, the horror, the horror, the horror, I must go mad, it's the end of civilization," unquote. This week in radical history for September 11th, 1926 in Italy, a group of anarchists nearly kill Mussolini as his car passes. The bomb thrown bounced off the windshield and bullets fly by. 26-year-old anarchist Lucchetti, convicted and sentenced to 30 years, would die in prison. Anarchists helped unite World War I when the Black Hand of Serbia killed Prince Ferdinand. Perhaps if they would have been successful in this attack, they could have helped curtail Hitler in World War II. A lot of history and potentiality in anarchism, the power of freedom and the power of chaos, are very potent forces indeed. Also on September 11, 1970, Ford introduces the Pinto despite knowing the design flaw causes the gas tank in the end to explode in collisions. Ford reasons that correcting the flaw would cost the company $137 million and lawsuits to settle any claims would only cost about $49 million. So they decide not to change the design. That's the ethics of capitalism for you. Lastly, for September 11, 1973 in Chile, CIA helps to overthrow democratically elected government, ending nearly 150 years of democratic rule in Chile. The CIA helps murder President Allende, folk singer Victor Jara, American IWW journalist Frank Turguji, and many, many others. Over 5,000 would die and many others disappear.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice, exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is important that it is presented each week on This Week in Palestine. And this is your host, John Roberts. We have a long feature presentation this morning, which is why we will get right to it. Miko Peled, author of The General's Son, spoke at the Community Church of Boston, and for those who might have missed it, we have his presentation on This Week in Palestine this morning. Miko Peled is the son of a famous Israeli military general who played a prominent role in the establishment of the State of Israel and the occupation of Palestine. But Miko has broken from his family's past and is now on the lecture trail calling for the establishment of justice for the Palestinian people. Here is Miko Peled speaking at the Community Church of Boston.
Well, thank you, Jill, for that excellent and very kind introduction. Thank you all for being here. It's a real pleasure to be here in Boston and to see a room full of people when there are so many other interesting things you can do in Boston. I'm not sure I would come to my own lecture knowing all the other things that you can do on an evening like tonight in Boston. So thank you all for being here. Thank you again, Jill, for the introduction, for the inspiration, for your leadership on so many issues, and for really connecting the dots between all these different important issues and realizing that it's really all the same struggle. I think that's really important. People often say, well, you know, Israel is the response to the Holocaust. And it's very strange because so many Holocaust survivors disagreed from the very beginning, of course, didn't go to Israel. Most of them, you know, stayed in other places, but opted to go to other places, return to their own homes. But this idea that the suffering of one nation somehow can be the solution for the suffering of another nation is so absurd. Sadly, so many people have bought into this idea that that's what Israel is all about, and that's why Israel should be what it should be. There's a wonderful Palestinian writer by the name of Hassan Kanafani. I don't know if any of you heard of him. But if you haven't, You should, because his stories, his short stories, are the best way to understand Palestine. Reading Ghassan Kanafani is really the most important thing we can do to really understand what happened in Palestine. Now, Ghassan Kanafani was killed by the Israelis, assassinated very brutally in 1972 in Beirut. He was also one of the leaders of the PFLP, which was the leftist portion of the Palestinian Liberation Movement. And he and his 16-year-old niece were both blown up by the Israelis in Beirut. But recently, about 6-8 months ago, an interview with Ghassan Kanafani surfaced online. It's very short. It's maybe 4 or 5 minutes long. I really urge you to look it up. It's in English. He's in Beirut in his office. And he's being interviewed by an Australian journalist. And probably the most remarkable thing about the interview is his demand for clarity. And when we talk about Palestine, clarity is something that is lacking. People call it a dispute. People call it an occupation. People call it a liberation. People call it this. People call it that. They call it Israel. They call it Palestine. People call it a conflict. People call it a war. In this interview, Ghassan Kanafani does not accept that premise at all.
Could you spell the last name?
Kanafani, K-A-N-A-F-A-N, like Nancy, I, Kanafani. And he insists that this is the struggle of a nation for liberation, the struggle to be allowed to return to your homes, a struggle of a nation that has been dispossessed, kicked out of their land, and forgotten by the rest of the world, and living in abject poverty in refugee camps. He goes on to say things that we're used to hearing white people say and accepting, like that Palestinians will fight to the last drop of blood. Palestinians would rather die standing. Things that, you know, we hear in other contexts and we think heroism, but when a Palestinian says it, of course, he's a terrorist. Because if a Palestinian says he's going to fight and he would rather die standing, then he must be a terrorist. And of course we know that Palestinians are killed whether they're standing or lying in their beds. And they have been killed like this for the last 7 decades. He just says it in a way that is absolutely so clear. And I watched it over and over again. I still watch it from time to time. I think it's really, really important, like I said, to read his work, but also and also to listen to this interview. And at one point, the reporter says to him, "Well, why don't you speak to the Israelis?" And Hassan kind of funny pauses. He looks up at the journalist and he says, "Talk about what?" And he says, "Peace, of course." So he pauses again and he says, "You mean capitulation?" And then he says that for Palestinians to talk, to negotiate with the Israelis, he said it would be a very strange conversation. He said it would be like a conversation between the sword and the neck. And we know, this was 1970, mind you, we know that every time the Palestinians did try to negotiate, did try to talk to the Israelis, the Israeli sword has gone deeper, cut deeper and deeper into the Palestinian neck. That is exactly what has happened when Palestinians did try to negotiate. And again, talking about the importance of this clarity, what do people call the country? When people go to visit, they'll say, "Oh, I visited Israel and I visited Palestine." Or, "I visited Israel-Palestine." Or, "I visited Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories." Well, which is it? If we say occupied Palestinian territories, that kind of suggests that there are somewhere Palestinian territories that are not occupied. Well, where are those Palestinian territories that are not occupied? There is no such thing. All of Palestine is occupied. There is no Israel and Palestine. There is no state of Palestine. It's both, really, because it depends on where you stand on the issue, whether you call it Israel or Palestine. Because either way, you're talking about the entire country. So if we accept that it's Israel, then we are legitimizing a 7-decade-long settler colonial project. that has been engaged in a vicious campaign of genocide and ethnic cleansing against the local indigenous population. That's what Zionism is. That's what Israel is. If we accept that the country is called Israel, then we are legitimizing what Israel has done. If we accept that people have a right to freedom, have a right to live, have a right to return to their homes, if we believe in justice and equality, then it's Palestine. If we reject settler colonialism, if we reject racism, then we have to call it Palestine. The name of the country is Palestine. And I think for people of conscience, and I suspect everybody in this room today qualifies within that community of people of conscience, or what's called the constituency of conscience, I think it's important for us to be clear, because if we're not clear, certainly other people are not going to be clear. So when people, when I talk about that country, I call it Palestine. And I'm, of course, you know, I'm called an Israeli. It's Palestine, because I will not accept, I reject this notion that I could legitimize this project of settler colonialism, ethnic cleansing, and genocide. And especially as someone whose family has been heavily engaged in that process for about 100 years now, going back to my grandparents. Now, again, for me, like you heard, I come from this very Zionist sphere, from a very Zionist family who's been involved. My grandfather was a signer on the Israeli Declaration of Independence. He was a young Zionist at the turn of the century. I have a poster at home advertising his lectures in Kiev in 1920, speaking about the situation in the land of Israel, you know. And he was part of that group of young Zionists who were really the diplomatic corps who went to the world and pretended that they represent Jewish people. And the reason they were successful is because they were highly educated. They were European. They were white. They spoke several languages. They shaved their beards. They didn't look like Jews. And so, you know, the countries, the powers that be of the time really accepted their narrative. But that's where I came from. And of course, my father, both my parents were born in Palestine. And my father was a young officer in 1948. We were, of course, growing up very proud of that, because those were the people who handed us the land of Israel on a silver platter. And then he was a general in 1967. And then, as an Israeli, where the military is above everything, that generation of the generals of the 1967 war, were the gods of the Olympus. You could not wish to have anything greater than that as a father. Because those were the ones, everybody knew their names, everybody knew what they did, where they came from, where they fought, I mean everything. These were the gods of the Olympus. And so, you know, the subtitle of my book is Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. The General Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. To me, the second part is much more interesting, because the journey goes on. But what is that journey when you're talking about such a small country? I mean, geographically speaking, distance, in terms of distance, it's a very short journey. Palestine is a very small country. And as an Israeli growing up, you know, Palestinians are never more than 10-minute drive. I mean, there's a Palestinian community everywhere. Sometimes the communities are across the street from each other. But the segregation is so deep and so effective that you don't see them. You know they exist, but you don't know that they exist. So my journey is really the journey of the privileged settler, you know, coming from the privileged settler colonial sphere into the sphere of the other, the native. The one who's darker, the one who's dirty, the one who's violent, the one that can't be trusted, the one that's lazy, and on and on and on, all these things that we know to say about the other. When we come, so that was really the journey of that sphere. So geographically speaking, distance-wise, the journey is very short. Politically, psychologically, it's an enormous journey. Because we are taught that we can't, you know, this is dangerous. It's a dangerous thing. Today, there's a wall. And there are checkpoints. And there are big signs as you cross a checkpoint from one side to the other, warning you in Hebrew, some of them are in English too now, that you're about to enter Palestinian territories, that it's a felony to enter Palestinian territories, and that it is life-threatening. And it's interesting because at the end they always have like two or three exclamation marks. Because if you're not impressed by the fact that you might be killed or you're committing a felony, then of course you need the exclamation marks to, you know, drive the point through across. It is insane. And when you get to that point, there's no way that you don't think twice and go, okay, do I really want to do this? So that is the journey. Now, I cross them all the time now. I don't even see them anymore, those signs. But in the beginning, this was a difficult journey to take, even though, again, like I said, geographically and distance-wise, it's a very short journey. And having taken that journey, what do you see? Why are the Palestinian towns, and you hear this from people who visit all the time, especially if they're visiting, you know, Israel. The Palestinian side is dusty. The lawns are not green. The houses don't seem to be quite as clean. It's kind of dirty and just, you know, run down. What's wrong with them? What's wrong with these Arabs? Look at what a beautiful job the Jews did, you know, in making the desert bloom. And look at this, you know. And sometimes it's across the street. And you have to wonder, what is it? What's wrong with them? What you don't know is, unless you investigate, the Palestinians receive 3% of the water. They're allocated. Israel has its own water authority, Mekorot, which is also, by the way, one of the targets of the BDS movement because they're exporting their knowledge on how to make the desert bloom. So Mekorot controls all of the water. Palestinians are allocated 3% of the water. Now, sometimes what that means is that a Palestinian town will get 10 or 12 hours of water per week. When exactly the water will be available, nobody really knows for sure. But when you know all you have is 12 hours of water per week and you have a family, you have to prioritize. Across the street, you have Israeli towns, Israeli settlements. They get all the water they need, more than they need. There's no limit on the amount of water you get as an Israeli. You wouldn't dream of not having water in the tap for a shower, for laundry, for watering your plants, drinking. I mean, that's not even an issue. So of course everything is green and clean and looks wonderful. If you don't know that this is the reality, you don't know. And certainly, unless you're going to shoot someone, denying them water is a pretty sure way of killing them. So this is the reality. So again, having taken that journey, I realize this. I also realize that they live under different laws. You know, we grew up thinking, and here in America, certainly people certainly believe that Israel is a democracy. And look, they even have Arabs in the parliament, in the Knesset, and they vote. Of course it's a democracy, and they get to ride the bus. What we don't know, unless we investigate, is those, I'm talking about the citizens, the Palestinians who do have Israeli citizenship, in what is called, again, this is one of those ridiculous terms, Israel proper. Which is Israel pre-1967, they do not live under the same laws. They do not live in the same reality. They do not enjoy the same privileges. They do get to vote. But everybody knows how they vote. And in the Israeli Knesset, they know exactly how many members they're going to have. So no important decisions are ever made where they have to rely on them for a vote. They're excluded from everything. So it's a very it's a very effective system, really, of ignoring the other while allowing them to vote. They figured it out quite well. And really, the Palestinians who are Israeli citizens live under the control of the Israeli secret police, which is called the Shabak. Not, you know, the model is taken from many of the Arab countries where all the citizens, or you know, other dictatorships where the citizenship is really citizenry, all live under the secret police. So Palestinians who are Israeli citizens live under that. And I'll give you an interesting example. Now, besides that, there are dozens of laws that the Israeli Knesset passed that discriminate against those people specifically. For example, you know, the Nakba, the Palestinian catastrophe. May 15th is Nakba Day. State institutions are not allowed to mention the Nakba, or they will lose funding. So a gentleman that I know is a vice principal of a Palestinian school. And apparently, last year, during Nakba Day, one of the teachers hinted Maybe they were a kufiya or something, I'm not sure, but they hinted in class. The next morning, the principal got a phone call from the intelligence department within the education department. In other words, the education department has an intelligence office which deals with the Arabs. And they already knew that next morning that a teacher in that school mentioned the Nakba. And they called to reprimand the principal and tell him to warn the teachers. Okay, that's how they operate. That would never happen in Israel to an Israeli Jewish teacher. That will never happen. No such thing exists. So they don't live under different laws. They don't live under different reality. They don't have the same same resources. There are no similarities at all. It's a completely different life. It's a completely different sphere. Then you have the Palestinians who live in the West Bank who live under military law. An entirely different story. And then you have the Palestinians who live in Jerusalem who live under different laws, a different status. So I grew up, I'm from Jerusalem. I've been out of the country for more than 20 years. I don't lose my citizenship. I can come, I can go, I have a house. No one's going to take my house away. A Palestinian from Jerusalem, if they have another passport, if they have another citizenship, their ID is taken. They can't come back. They can come back as a tourist. Their land is taken away. Their homes are taken away. An entirely different system. Now, if you don't take the journey, you're not going to know. If you don't take the journey, if you don't go to the other side, how will you know? We always assume that, you know, if they're dirty, it's probably because there's something wrong with them. If they're in prison, that's because something is wrong with them. If they're killed by the soldiers or the police, there's probably something wrong with them. Because we are okay. We're good people. Look at us. I mean, after all, we're Jews, we're Israelis, and so on. We're the good guys here. So that is that. That's the value of the journey. And again, like I said, that's why for me, that part of the story, besides the fact that it's ongoing and it's still going on, is really the more interesting part of that. Now, the whole idea of this two-state solution, where the West Bank and the Gaza Strip are supposedly one part, the rest of the country is another part, exists in order to do one thing. It exists in order to legitimize the conquest and the occupation of 1948 and allow time to go by while the second part or the completion of the occupation when Israel took the West Bank and Gaza becomes, you know, irreversible. That's what it's about. There hasn't been any intent on the Israeli part to ever allow the Palestinians any kind of recognition, any kind of rights, or recognition of any of their rights. But it was a great tactic, and it worked. Today, there is no West Bank. There is no West Bank. There's a Judea and Samaria regions of the State of Israel. They have the police force have a little pin, the pin is the map of the West Bank, and it says Judea and Samaria. Any bureaucracy that you can think of, state bureaucracy, is available there, but only to the Jewish citizens. Palestinians live under military law. They're governed by the military. So if I'm in the West Bank, in a village, in a protest, and I get arrested, I go through a certain path. A Palestinian arrested in the same place for the same violation has an entirely different experience. You know, I get taken to the police, I get to see my lawyer, I get to call a lawyer at the end of the day. Last time I didn't get to go home, they insisted to keep me to lock me up for 24 hours, but normally I go home. A Palestinian is thrown in prison, beaten, tortured, and kept in a cell for as long as some officer decides. It could be a year, it could be a month, it could be a day. Nobody knows. And a Palestinian will not see a lawyer until they confess. They will not see a lawyer until they confess. So they have to be tortured. Again, there is no equality. There is no democracy. Now, people talk about the one-state solution, so to speak, as though it is something futuristic, as though we have this option. We can opt for one state, we can opt for two states, we have all these options like a buffet. There is no option. Israel created a single state over all of Palestine with exclusive rights for Jewish people, period. Period. It's done. There are no parts of the country where you can slice off and say, well, this will be a Palestine, this will be an Israel. There's no such place. I mean, the two populations live in such proximity, it's impossible to do. It wouldn't be the right thing to do anyway, but it would be impossible. So today there's a single state. Now, the thing that people don't like to hear is the word apartheid. The thing that people don't like to hear is ethnic cleansing, and the thing that people the most don't want to hear is genocide. How can you say that Jews would be engaged in genocide? My thing is, the words offend you? You're offended by the words? You're not offended by the actions? You're not offended by the fact that different populations live under different laws? That we who are settlers and the children of settlers have privileges that the people whose land this is can't enjoy? Never mind the ones who have been kicked out and are living in refugee camps? That doesn't bother you? A campaign of ethnic cleansing that's been going on for 7 decades. Ethnic cleansing, planned, well thought out, well executed. Still going on today in Jerusalem, in Hebron, in the Negev Desert in the south, where there are supposedly Israeli citizens. Thousands and thousands of people being kicked off their lands, villages being destroyed, homes being destroyed. That doesn't bother you? This methodical campaign of ethnic cleansing doesn't bother you? The name is the problem? And genocide. How can you say that Jews would ever be involved in genocide? Well, there's a Geneva Convention. Look at the definition of the crime of genocide. Compare that to what Israel has been doing for 7 decades. A destruction of a people. A destruction of a people. Can anybody say that Israel has not been engaged in the destruction of the Palestinian people? Monuments? Land? Changing names? Not to mention changing the name of the entire country, but changing names of places? Allowing historical monuments to fall apart? Keeping people under such strict rules that you know they're going to die? And in the Geneva Convention, it clarifies that there has to be intent. In other words, if you kill 1,000 people but there was no intent, then it's not genocide. Fine. If we look at the record of the state of Israel over the last 7 decades, can anyone have any doubt? Is there any doubt that there was intent? When we see the plans, we see the execution. How can there be any doubt that there's... When it was, it's interesting, in 2014, was it 2014? Maybe it was 2008. One of the massacres in Gaza. After one of the massacres in Gaza, the UN decided to. I think this thing isn't working. The UN decided to send in a to investigate, to see if war crimes took place, to see if war time if war crimes took place in Gaza. This isn't working, is it? No. Okay, that's fine. They need a committee to go in and investigate if war crimes were committed. The fact that warplanes dropped millions of tons of bombs on a civilian population that had nowhere to go, that's not enough proof? You need a committee to investigate if there are war crimes? Is it, okay, better? Okay, sorry. So this whole idea that somehow that we need to investigate whether there was intent, we need to make sure, of course there's intent. When you drop a million tons of bombs on a civilian population, you know you're going to kill them. And then we do it again, and then you do it again, and then you do it again. So I don't think genocide is problematic. Genocide is what's been going on. And until we speak clearly about this, and until we use the exact terms, the precise terms, to describe Israel, to describe what Israel has done, to describe the reality in Palestine, it's not going to change. Because we are the voice of... Thank you.
Sorry.
We are the... No worries. The constituency of conscience. We're the people that are bringing out the message. And the one thing that people often say, yes, but our Jewish friends, you know, it really hurts their feelings. We don't want to offend our Jewish neighbors. I can understand that. But if these Jewish neighbors support racism, apartheid, and genocide, why are they your friends to begin with? You know? Why do you tolerate this? So these are all important issues. But again, going back to this idea of the one state exists. And in many ways, I think we owe a debt, not a debt, but we should thank Donald Trump for bringing the conversation to a point where the conversation, not just the two-state solution, it's been dead for a long, it was dead on arrival, but the two-state solution conversation is now over. And he empowered members of the Israeli government to speak more honestly now as well. I mean, they never intended to allow Palestinians to have their own state or make peace with them, but they pretended to. Now they dropped the facade. They have a president who loves them and supports them, and they love him back. And when he visited, I was there when Trump visited. It was a love affair. It was disgusting. But they can say whatever they do, and they do. There is no two-state solution. The settlements are never leaving. Good. We knew that already. Now, are we okay with an apartheid regime? Or is this going to be a democracy? That's the conversation we want to have, because now it is absolutely clear that it is an apartheid regime. It has been intended to be an apartheid regime from the very beginning, and that is exactly what is unacceptable. That is what we won't stand for. And I think now that it's so clear that this whole facade of an Israel that loves peace and an Israel that only wants peace, that facade has been tossed away, then we can have this honest conversation. Is it going to be an apartheid regime, or is it going to be a democracy? Now, you know, Jill touched on the BDS issue. I don't know if you saw or heard Chuck Schumer gave a talk at some Jewish organization, I think it was in June. And he referred to the BDS movement as this modern type of anti-Semitism, kind of a sly, secret kind of form of anti-Semitism, which pretends to, you know, want good things, but is really deep down a form of anti-Semitism. If we look at the goals of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, they're declared, they're written, it's very simple. Ending the occupation, the military occupation, which is something the international community has been demanding for decades. Equal rights for the Palestinian citizens of the State of Israel, which is something that should have happened and should have been demanded, but you know, people think it's already there. And the right of the Palestinian refugees to return to their homes and their land, which again has been accepted by the international community and enshrined in a UN resolution. Where's the racism? It doesn't even mention Jews. Where's the anti-Semitism? It doesn't talk about persecution, killing, kicking anybody out. Where's the anti-Semitism? Where's the racism? What are they talking about? What are they talking about? Three very simple, very reasonable, remedial demands. They don't even deal with the problem, which is the settler colonial people like myself, the Jews that live in Palestine. It's all remedial. It's all to bring the Palestinians back to where they need to be. There is no discussion, there is no demand. There's not even a demand for reparations, which I believe should be. Maybe that'll be the, once that happens, then maybe people in America will wake up and start discussing reparations for blacks, as they should have done a long time ago. But there's not even a demand for reparations. Where's the racism? What is all this nonsense? It's complete and utter nonsense. There was a conference in Jerusalem last year, How to Fight the BDS, sponsored by Yediot Ahronot, which is a big Israeli newspaper, and Stand With Us, which has an organization that has very deep pockets, and a few other organizations. And I was in Jerusalem, so I attended. I signed up and I attended. You know, there's a story about a witch that goes to visit a village, or not a village, a city, and she puts a little drug in the water, in the well, that makes people crazy. So everybody who drank from the well became crazy, but the king had his own well. So he was the only one that wasn't crazy, but because everybody became insane, they thought he was crazy, he had no choice but to drink from the well. That's how I felt in that conference. Thousands of people who were absolutely nuts, who lived in a reality that is unbelievable. There's no occupation. There's no injustice. We did nothing wrong. It's all anti-Semitism. It's all terrorism. And, by the way, there were Mossad operatives who were there speaking. It was an all-day event. All the top people in Israel were there. The president, all the way down. Members of Knesset, journalists, Ron Lauder was there, Jewish billionaire. And the Mossad operative said, the Mossad has not yet used all of its tools to fight this, because this is a form of terrorism. And the face of this terrorism is Omar Barghouti. I don't know if you know, but he's the kindest, gentlest man you'll ever meet. And Ali Abu Nima, who runs the Electronic Intifada, another very kind, gentle man that wouldn't hurt a fly. Those are the faces of this terrorism. And there were thousands of people there. Free food, really good food. I mean, it was insane. So the press was there. And they really do not see that anything is wrong. So there's anti-Semitism, and then there's a few innocent, naive Jews who have been pulled into this. That's the BDS. You know, they plan to fight it. And they've done, the TV, Israeli TV has done programs on it and so on and so forth. Which goes to show, you know, if you don't know anything about the BDS movement and its successes and its and the campaigns it's had, it goes to show that it's working. Because they're terrified. And if they can't kill it, they don't know what to do with it. They don't know what to do with an enemy that they can't kill. And you can't kill the BDS movement. There's nothing to kill. Who are they going to kill? Everybody? Even if they get, God forbid, you know, harm Omar Barghouti, who lives in Palestine, that won't be the end of the BDS movement. They don't know what to do with it if they can't kill it, and they can't kill it, and it's being very successful. More and more churches here in America are voting to divest. More and more people are boycotting. Boycotting HP, boycotting Veolia around the world, boycotting Caterpillar. There are many successful campaigns. People are divesting in Europe. Banks are divesting from Israeli companies. Pension plans are divesting from Israeli companies and so on. So they're feeling it. Even the defense industry has seen around a 40% decline in sales, which is significant. Dealing with Israel has become toxic. It's just become unpleasant. It's not good for public opinion. There's plenty of work to do. Don't worry, they're selling plenty of guns. But there's still, the campaigns are working very, very well. Like I said, Mikorot, the Israeli Water Authority, is out there selling itself in third world countries as this, you know, wonderful system of making the desert bloom. So that's now being targeted as well. But also, I mean, what's more basic and simple than boycotting? You go to the store, it says made in Israel, you don't buy it. Done. You've contributed to the struggle. If you want to go to the next step, you speak to the store manager and you say, look, you shouldn't have these things here because there's a boycott. If you want to take it to the next level, you get somebody to come in every single day to talk to the manager, and then you send letters every day, and suddenly he's going to say, no, this is a headache. Forget all this made in Israel stuff. You know, we're not making that much money off it anyway. And it could be an avocado, or it could be Moroccan shampoo, which, by the way, is made in Israel, or couscous, or hummus, and all the different kinds that Israel makes. And they're feeling it. They're feeling it, and they're terrified. Now, all the claims of anti-Semitism, of terrorism, of how it's not fair and violent is complete nonsense. It is dedicated. Very dedicated. It is persistent. Very persistent. It's not going away until this is over. In other words, this movement is going to go to the very end until Palestine is free. That is absolutely clear. And that is what scares them. That is exactly what scares them. Then we stand here with this. Jill's got one. Ursula in the back has got one. I mean, you know, it's something that now we're talking about and we're wearing proudly, and this is it. You know, boycotting Israel. So they're denying people to come in. So if you're a BDS activist, if they know you're a BDS activist, they don't let you come in. What are they going to do? Deny everybody eventually? So it was just non-Jews. Now it's Jews too. They just denied a couple of Jews, a couple of rabbis and so forth. I mean, it's insane. They're going to deny it. So they're denying people from churches who come to see Palestine and help Palestinians. They're denying young activists who come to support Palestine. Now they're denying Jews who they suspect might be going in to deny. I mean, pretty soon they're going to have to deny everyone. It's an insane kind of... It's not paranoia because it's justified. I mean, the BDS is coming after them. The BDS is being successful. Like I said, the BDS is not going to stop until it's over. But their response is absolutely hysterical. completely hysterical, and there's a sense that they've done nothing wrong. They're the victims here. 2 million people in the Gaza Strip are, and it's very, very hot there in the summer, dying of heat and thirst. 2 million people. Think of the hospitals. Think of newborns. Think of older people who need medical care. Think of people who need surgery. Never mind day-to-day people that need a glass of clean water. There is no clean water in Gaza. Electricity has been reduced to 2-3 hours every few days. 2 million people. We're not talking about a small town of, 50,000. We're talking about 2 million people in a concentration camp. In one of the most visible, high-profile places in the world. It's 3 hours to Rome. It's 3.5 hours flight from Paris. Never mind, it's an hour drive from Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, where you wouldn't dream of not having electricity, air conditioning, water. 5 minutes sometimes from Israeli towns or along the border of Gaza, where you wouldn't dream of not having all the water you need. You know, a child has a toothache or an ear infection, you give them antibiotics. Imagine your child has an ear infection and there are no antibiotics. Never mind the bombing and the people who died from that. From that horror. Simple things. So their problem is the BDS movement. That it offends their Jewish friends. The BDS is dedicated. It's the right thing to do. Israel should be boycotted completely. It should be kicked out of FIFA. It should be kicked out of the Olympics. They should not be represented in cultural issue affairs, academic institutions. Israel should be a pariah. It should be isolated. Being the Israeli, an Israeli diplomat, whether it's the consul general in the big cities here in the U.S., or it's the ambassador, should be the worst job in the world. And it's getting to a point where it is. They should not be welcome anywhere. There should be protests every time they show up. Hell, they should be sent back to Tel Aviv. And every decent country should call their ambassador back from Tel Aviv. That is the way it should be. And that's, I think, where it's going to go. It's going to take a little more time, and it's going to take more effort from all of us. It's not going to happen by heavenly decree. It's going to happen when we do our job. But I think it's incredibly important that we do that, that we make sure we're there, that there's always a presence. In some places in Europe, like in Ireland, for example, I know to be the Israeli ambassador is the worst job in the world. It is the worst job in the world. Nobody wants that job. In fact, Israeli diplomats had a strike about a year ago. They said they're not getting paid enough to do all this. It's such a hellish job. But this is important. This is incredibly important. That's how it's done. South Africans didn't one day, develop wings and a halo and became saints and decided to accept blacks. They were brought to their knees. Apartheid had to come down. I'm sure Mandela was offered a deal a couple of years before he was allowed out, before apartheid fell. A little compromise, this and that. He said, thank you very much. I'm going back to Robben Island. This was in the mid-80s. By 94, he was president of South Africa. Less than 10 years later, he was president of a free South Africa. But it didn't happen. It wasn't a miracle. There was a lot of hard work done in South Africa and outside of South Africa. And the South Africa was a pariah. They couldn't play rugby. They couldn't play rugby anywhere. The South, in New Zealand, they wanted this apartheid nonsense to end because they wanted to play rugby with the South Africans. They couldn't. That was one thing that pushed people to support apartheid, just to get this thing over with so we can start playing rugby again with all our friends. These are the kinds of things that make a difference. So that's BDS. It's dedicated. It's the right thing to do. We should all be there. We should support it. We should push for it. We should discuss it. We should convince other people to participate in it. And when all these lunatics, corrupt lunatics like Schumer and others, try to pass laws to make it illegal, and every, governor after governor, state legislature after state legislature around the country pass these ridiculous laws, we should be there. Fine. Arrest all of us. Arrest all of us. Same thing is happening in Europe, by the way. More and more countries in Europe are trying to pass to criminalize the BDS. They haven't all succeeded, but they're all trying. So that is our job. That is what we need to do. Last thing I want to talk about is this issue of, everything that's Palestinian has to be delegitimized. Everything that's Palestinian has to be equated with terrorism. The resistance is terrorism. Armed resistance, of course, is terrorism because it's armed resistance. Palestinians do not have a right to bear arms and fight their oppressors. Unarmed resistance is also terrorism. Palestinians do not have a right to stand up and demand freedom. Palestinian culture is terrorism. Palestinian art is terrorism. I don't know if you know, there was this exhibit of Palestinian kids drew pictures from Gaza. That was terrorism. And the final frontier is Palestinian charities. You cannot raise money for Palestine without being equated with terrorism now. I have a book that's about to come out in a couple of months, and it's about a case called the Holy Land Foundation. The Holy Land Foundation was the largest Muslim charity in America. After 9/11, they were closed down. Their assets were frozen. Everybody thought it was just a matter of time. You know, go to court, everything will be fine. They did nothing wrong. Didn't work. 2008, there was a trial. Ended with a mistrial. 2009, there was another second trial. 5 good men are in federal prison, 2 of them for 65 years. Innocent men. Muslim American Palestinians, Palestinian descent. Did nothing wrong, never heard a fly. 65 years. Appeal was denied, Supreme Court wouldn't take it, and Obama wouldn't even look at them. Now, how do you equate charity with terrorism? Who is the sick genius that thought of this? It was members of the ADL, by the way, the Anti-Defamation League, which pretends to be a civil rights organization. Really, they're a racist, fascist organization. It should be outlawed because they support terrorism. How do you equate charity with terrorism? Where do you even start? Well, they said they have an orphans program, and the orphan program supports the children of suicide bombers. Well, this was said in the trial by, what's his name, Levitt. I forgot his first name. He's a terrorism expert in Washington, D.C. It's well known that if somebody knows that their families are going to be taken care of, that they would agree to become a terrorist. It makes perfect sense. If I knew that my family was going to be taken care of, I would go and blow myself up. Wouldn't everybody? This is the reasoning. But you look at the list of orphans, the case of the Holy Land Foundation. You look at the orphans, and the names of the children. You look at the father's cause of death. None of them were related to terrorism. They're called shaheed because shaheed is a term of respect for the dead. So you didn't die for, it's not like they died for nothing. So the term of shaheed is not only to suicide bombers. Shaheed is somebody who dies and we respect their, out of respect. So none of the children's fathers had anything to do, their death had anything to do with terrorism. During the 90s, there were a lot of suicide bombers. There haven't been suicide bombers in a very long time. But in the 90s, there were suicide bombers. None of them had children. 194, 195 suicide bombers, none of them had children. So either way you look at it, none of these children being orphans has anything to do with terrorism. But why ruin a good story with the facts? These guys supported orphans, they supported terrorism. Then they said, look, they're supporting the families of prisoners. And this, by the way, is happening now all over Europe. It's happening here in the U.S. And it just happened in Palestine. Israel forced the Palestinians to close down the Palestinian National Fund, which supports the families of prisoners, among other things. They said, see, they're supporting terrorism by supporting the families of prisoners. Why are they in prison? They must be terrorists. So again, the same logic. If I know my family is going to be taken care of, I don't mind sitting in prison for 25 years. The same logic. But according to Israeli sources, forget what Palestinians are saying, because Palestinians are Arabs, we can't trust them, right? But look at Israeli sources. According to Israeli sources, the vast majority, over 90% of the Palestinians sitting in Israeli prisons have never been charged with acts of violence. We're talking about the Israeli military court, where the bar is set very low. The vast majority have never been charged with acts of violence. They're not terrorists anyway. They're all political prisoners. They belonged to political movements that Israel does not like. But again, why ruin a good story with the facts? And in a courthouse in the Northern District of Texas, the fact that the U.S. government said that they were terrorists, the fact that the government of Israel said they were terrorists is good enough. So two men are in for 65 years, one for 20 years, and the two other ones for 15 years in federal prison. All of them are older than me. The youngest one, I believe, is almost 60, 59 years old. So we're talking about 20 years is a very long time. 65 years is really a life. And they're innocent. I've been to prisons, I've traveled, I've seen them in prison. So this is the final frontier, this nonsense about, and it's impossible now to raise money for Palestinians. And the need is greater and greater every day because of the very authority that is supposed to take care of them, which is the state of Israel, is neglecting its responsibility. Why is there such poverty anyway? Why are Palestinians living in poverty? Why do they have jobs and water and food and so forth? Why? Because Israel has imposed the economics of apartheid on them. They're educated. Every other person in Gaza, I've been to Gaza, is a PhD. You say, but you see, there's Hamas. Hamas. What you're going to do is Hamas. We can't just, let them free and they shoot rockets. Why is there Hamas? Hamas is a resistance organization. Why are there resistance organizations? Because there's oppression and occupation. The problem is not the resistance. The problem is the cause for the resistance. Yeah, but they have tunnels. Of course they have tunnels. It's locked up. There's no way to get food or water or oil or money or medicine or anything. They have to have tunnels. Why do they need tunnels? The problem is not the fact that they're digging tunnels. The problem is the fact that they need to dig tunnels. Why are they fighting? Why is there Hamas? There was no Hamas originally. It didn't come from heaven. Hamas is a part of the Palestinian resistance movement. That's why it's there. If there was no oppression, there's no resistance, there wouldn't have been Hamas. But the problem is always the victim. A victim that dares to stand. A victim that stands to rise. A victim that dares to demand justice and freedom and rights. They are the problem. How dare they demand? That is always the problem. Whether it's blacks in America, whether it's in South Africa, whether it's Palestine, whether it's anywhere else where there's injustice. How dare they stand up and demand? So they are always the problem. Israel drops millions of tons of bombs, it's Hamas' fault. Because they shot a rocket. Of course they're going to shoot a rocket. You put two million people in a prison, they're not going to fight? How many of the 2 million people have shot rockets? Okay, not that many. Homes demolished. Homes demolished. Entire towns turned into ghost towns. Because they don't have a permit. They built without a permit. This is happening all over Palestine. They built without a permit. In Jerusalem alone, there are 15,000 homes that have a demolition order. 15,000 homes in Jerusalem only. But you know what's interesting? None of them are Jewish homes. Why, Jews don't build without a permit? I know Jews who built without a permit. I know quite a few Jews who built a balcony, a second story, a little apartment for their kids, tucked away. Where the authorities can't see without a permit. You never see the army come in with these big bulldozers and destroying Jewish homes. It only happens when Palestinians have problems with the permit. If it's a Jewish permit, they get a fine. They go to court, they get an extension, they pay the permit next year. No Palestinians, no. Doesn't matter if it's the West Bank, by the way, or there, Israel proper. The bulldozers come in, the police come in with their stormtroopers, and they destroy homes. Entire villages, entire towns, between Jerusalem and Ramallah, entire towns became ghost towns. This is the great democracy that all of our taxpayers' money, by the way, is supporting. So, in conclusion, like I said in the beginning, clarity is crucial. Standing up is crucial. Speaking up is crucial. And for all of us sitting here, particularly, finding hope is crucial. We who sit here today, as they say, rich, free, and alive, all at the same time, do not have the luxury to say it's hopeless. Never mind the fact that our tax dollars are funding this disaster. But we do not have the luxury to say it's hopeless. We have to find hope, and then we have to act. We have to find hope, and we have to act. Now, it's quite simple. Like I said earlier, there are only two choices. One choice is what is the reality today, where there's a racist apartheid regime that offers me exclusive rights at the expense of Palestinians. It comes with bombing Gaza, political prisoners, people dying of thirst and heat where they shouldn't, destructions of homes, ethnic cleansing, genocide. It's a package deal. Supporting Israel is a package deal. This is Israel. There's no other kinder, gentler version of Israel. This is it. Settler colonialism 101. They invented nothing new. But there is another option. There is the option of a free democratic Palestine. A free democratic Palestine that respects human rights, that allows the refugees to return to their homes and their land, equal rights, without checkpoints, without soldiers, without racist laws, without a secret police, without the bombings. That is the other, there is another option. Which one of these two options presents hope? Everybody's got to make their own mind. It's got nothing to do with politics. It's values. Which one presents hope? Racism and genocide, or freedom and democracy? Those are two options. I would argue that a free democratic Palestine with equal rights is the way to go. That's where hope lies. That's why we need to support BDS. That's the banner behind which we all need to align. And thankfully, the Green Party is aligned with that. Yes. The only political party, not only in the U.S., the only Green Party, I think, in the world that has taken that courageous step, that has it in the platform. When I saw Jill at the convention, she asked me, I said to her proudly, I'm a member of a Green Party now. She said, that wouldn't happen to have anything to do with our stance on Palestine, would it? I said, yeah, well, as a matter of fact, that's exactly what. I mean, this is the only place, interestingly enough, here in the U.S. is the only place where there's a political party that does carry these things on its banner, and many other important things too. And I say this with complete confidence. If we do our job, if we act, then Palestine can absolutely be free and will absolutely be free. But we must act and we must do the right thing. Thank you all very much.
You have been listening to Miko Peled speaking at the Community Church of Boston. Is there a conspiracy? Yes. Are we being manipulated and controlled and guided into a new world order and a new world religion? Yes. Is there a group in charge of this who's been in charge all along who are bringing this about? Yes. And I can tell you, folks, they're as old as man. They're the followers of an ancient religion that has persisted even unto this day.
To BCFM's politics show 9/11 16th anniversary special with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, author Ian Henshaw, and me, Tony Gosling. And joining us on the line, I'm hoping now, from the United States is Chris Bolin. Hi, Chris, and welcome to the politics show. Can you hear me, Chris? Yeah, so it doesn't sound like we've got a very good link to Chris Bolin there, which is a pity. But maybe, Martin, you could help us out here a little bit, because Chris has made quite a lot of links between the Israelis and 9/11. And there's quite a lot of people around the world who are saying, well, actually, that's just anti-Semitic. You have to be a Nazi to say things like that.
Well, the fact is, were they connected to it, yes or no? And the answer is yes, and there's quite strong evidence. For example, the five dancing Israelis who were seen celebrating when the first plane hit the first tower, and they were seen on the top of a white van, and somebody noticed them and took the van's registration number, gave it to the police. 8 hours later, the van was stopped, they were arrested, and it turned out that they were Mossad agents, the people in the van, and that they were filming the attack. They were interrogated by the American authorities for several weeks, and eventually they got back to Israel and they went on television in Israel and said, yes, we were Mossad and we were filming the attack, but it was nothing suspicious, we were just documenting what was happening, documenting a supposed surprise attack on the United States of America. And that's one link to the potential involvement of Israel and the Mossad in 9/11.
Well, there's another one, isn't there? And that's that quite a lot of people involved in the subsequent cover-up and the investigation were dual US-Israeli citizens.
That's true. And you've got... if you think about the... We're talking about motive before the break. There's two big motives. So the US military-industrial complex needs enemies because it needs they need money. And the Israelis have got a plan to balkanize the Middle East, the Yinon plan, and they need the Americans and the British as well as junior partners to help them dominate the Middle East. So we've got a fairly straightforward explanation.
Shortly before 9/11, Israel was an absolute low point in its global popularity. Colin Powell walked out, the American Secretary of State walked out of a UN meeting in protest against the fact that they wouldn't buy the sort of support for Israel any longer. 3 months later, after 9/11, it was game, set and match to Israel. Politically, they were sending experts around, so-called experts around, helping practically every government in the world deal with terrorism. They went from the bad guys to the good guys overnight. Huge benefits for them.
Also, the Israelis are very, very keen on sort of high-tech stuff, aren't they? Particularly software.
They are. I mean, and in actual fact, all of the airports where the planes took off from on 9/11 were... most people may not realise this, but there's a huge private security industry out there that runs airports, but it's not actually... controlled by the governments of the countries concerned where the airports are. So ICTS is an Israeli-based security company, closely linked to the Mossad, although it's a private company, and they control all three airports on 9/11 in terms of getting people on and off planes, and they also control Schiphol Airport, where the underpants bomber was let onto the plane without going through security, because we got eyewitnesses saying that, and the shoe bomber also. Richard Wright, whatever his name
was. Reed
got on at Schiphol. Don't forget that this war on terror is a huge boondoggle for private security companies. And who's the experts on trying to stop terrorism in the whole world? Oh, it's the Israelis. So they then get the contracts. But of course, if they are actually perpetrators, then being in charge of security in airports, I mean, you'd think if you're a terrorist, why would you want to attack an airport? Well, it's full of security.
It's interesting, isn't it, that Chris Bolen, when he tried to come to speak on Ken O'Keefe's show on the David Icke channel, something called The People's Voice, which ran for a while until they ran out of money and there were various factional infighting going on there. This is back in January 2014. Chris Bolen was stopped at the airport and told that he wouldn't be allowed to enter the country because there was some sort of outstanding warrant for him in the United States. So he was sent back home. He wasn't allowed to come on that program. But it almost seems like this whole security industry, they seem to be working hand in hand. And to actually stop him coming into the UK to go on the TV, of course, that doesn't stop him talking on Skype, although he hasn't been able to talk on Skype today with us, unfortunately, when we're in the new studio. It's the first time we've used Skype in here, so there may be some other problem with it. But this whole private security industry, and it's not just private security, it's also the private arms industry and private military companies have absolutely exploded as part of this war on terror. In fact, many of these troops, the Americans a couple of weeks ago said they're sending 4,000 new troops to Afghanistan, many of those will be effectively mercenaries.
That's right.
I've got to say that I've got a slightly different model of this. I would see whoever carried out the 9/11 attacks or, planned it as being a criminal conspiracy. I think that's really the best way politically to go forward on this. We've just been infiltrated by a team of criminals who've unfortunately managed to bully youth.
But do you not buy this sort of geopolitical angle of the disruption of the Middle East?
What's happened over
such a long time.
I think that what we're talking about is a fairly small number of people who probably go to your Bilderberg group, maybe the plot was hatched there, but in a country, a state or a golf course, I don't know. But we're talking about a small number of people who orchestrated this, and we've got our suspects list, but what you find, actually, interestingly, is that there's like almost like one person from each agency. You've got, you know, you've got the Israelis, you can find links there, you can find links with the Pakistani intelligence, you can find links with the CIA, a lot of links with the CIA, with the Saudis. So what I think we're really looking at is a network, a sort of mafia-type network, and in just the same way as drugs networks have their man in the police tipping them off, this network has its, they want somebody everywhere important. And I don't think really the upper level of global power is nation-based. I think it's network-based. And these are what people known as the neocons. I mean, that's the whole point about the neocons. They could be Israeli, they could be British, they could be Washington people. So, yes, Israel hugely benefited and undoubtedly will have helped, but you know, and had probably had prior knowledge. But does that mean they organised it entirely themselves? I couldn't say that.
Martin, what about the bigger, talking about geopolitics, is the links, if you look at these big power blocks around the world, one of the effects of the war on terror has been it's been very much more difficult for countries to be independent under this kind of new global war on terror. We found many Eastern European countries, for example, the coup in the Ukraine, countries are just simply not allowed to be halfway between East and West. They have to make a decision. We're now settling out into effectively three main power blocks. And I don't know if you could critique, I may be wrong here, but it looks to me like the Western Europe and the United States as one. You've got China as another, with the Russians as another, kind of sandwiched in the middle. And pretty much everybody has got an alliance with one or the other of those three major groups.
Yeah, and the Russians and the Chinese are being pushed together by the belligerent attitude of the Western neoconservatives in power. I think, to comment on what Ian's just saying, I think, yes, it's clearly a criminal network, and that's a very important political thing to get hold of, because, of course, Imposimato, who's the head of the Italian Supreme Court, is basically saying, look, we've just got to arrest these people and put them on trial. And that's what we want. We want the people who did this, we want them arrested, and we want them put on trial.
And we want a very thorough investigation into the ancillary people gave them aid and comfort after this. And I'm afraid to say that's a lot of people in the mainstream media.
Well, that's right. But, I mean, all of that's got to be dealt with. And but, of course, ultimately, warfare is warfare. I'm pretty convinced that the Chinese and the Russians are know virtually everything we know about this. Don't forget, they've got far more resources to find this stuff out than we have as independent investigators. And they are trying to negotiate with the criminals that run the Western powers, and they're trying to sort of box them into a corner where they, you know, they're made to back down without a full-scale war. But the danger of full-scale war is definitely there. I mean, we could be at war with Korea this week. That's how dangerous this situation
is. There's an interesting parallel with the Watergate scandal, where President Nixon, Republican president, was deposed or forced to resign. And most people took it that he was forced there by the left, who objected to his the war in Vietnam. But what the Russians said, interestingly, was that he was actually being removed because he'd sought détente with the Russians, which he had done. There's no debate about that. And they thought the motive actually came from the right. And when Deep Throat was finally identified, the informant was... I mean, he was always convicted on the basis of CIA-released tape recordings. That's what nailed Nixon, the Watergate tapes. But later, you know, it turned out that it was the Deep Throat actually was a guy on the right in the FBI. He thought Nixon wasn't conservative enough. So, you know, that shows how the Russians... And now, I think, with hindsight, we'd probably mostly think that the Russian version's quite likely to be true. So, yeah, you know, they're pretty well... They shouldn't be taken... they shouldn't be laughed at, that's for sure.
One of the things that I noticed you did with your 9/11 network was you let them know that this show was going on, Ian. And one of the questions that came back from one of your people as part of the Reinvestigate 9/11 group, Pat Bernstein, or Bernstein, I'd probably mispronounce it there, is what he's saying is, or she's saying, I'm not sure whether Pat is a man or a woman, how do you open people's minds to the possibility? There's so much complex evidence that needs to be presented. What simple non-technical points can be used to open the eyes of those who've got no concept of what happened on 9/11? Actually, I'm going to ask you if you can sum up maybe three or four points, you first, Ian, and then you, Martin.
Well, I would mention Operation Northwoods. Most people decide first what they want to believe and then find, I'm sorry to say this, and then find the evidence to fit it. I mean, we all do to some extent.
Well, some would say the same about you.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I'd say we all do to some extent. So I think what you really need to challenge are people's blocks. You know, there's no point in hitting them with immense amounts of evidence. The block is...
Northwoods?
They wouldn't do it. Well, the answer to that's Operation Northwoods. They'd be sure to get caught. Well, the answer to that's compartmentalisation. There'd be some whistleblowers. The answer to that is there are whistleblowers. They just haven't been reported in the mainstream media. So I think those are the three. And then the anthrax attacks, which, you know, were blamed on Al-Qaeda, but actually turned out to come out
actually, one of the most interesting whistleblowers is this guy called Peter Ketchum, isn't he? Because he worked for the official investigators, the National Institute of Science and Technology.
So did Kevin Ryan as well. He's another very important whistleblower. Peter Ketchum has produced an extremely persuasive video. His detractors will say that he wasn't actually personally involved in the actual investigation, which I think is probably true, but he does have a great deal of knowledge of how NIST works, and he's explained effectively how NIST could have been nobbled, because a lot of people in the scientific world will tell you that NIST, which carried out these official investigations, is a totally respectable and trustworthy body, and most of the time they are quite trustworthy, but Peter Ketchum, as an insider in NIST, explains how they would have set up, and once again, of course, it's compartmentalisation. They chose some hand-picked investigators and kept them away from everybody else, just what Dick Cheney did in the CIA to justify the Iraq war, and possibly also his modus operandi if it was Cheney who did the organising for 9/11.
Jamie McPhail, who's also one on your list, mentions the anthrax attacks again,
yeah.
And he says another aspect of this which hasn't really been looked at is the death of a guy called Bruce Ivins, and I'm not sure
absolutely
who he is.
Well, he was framed by... I think it's, you know, not an exaggeration to say that he was framed by the FBI. When they couldn't get away from the fact that the anthrax came out of the US military industrial complex, the next thing to do was to blame it on an individual rather than the conspiracy. So they found this poor guy, Bruce Ivins, bullied him into basically committing suicide. But interestingly, his colleagues are standing by him, and there's an immense amount of evidence that Bruce Ivins couldn't have done it, even if he'd wanted to. He just didn't have the right access to the anthrax laboratories. So, you know, but yeah, Jamie McPhail's absolutely right about that. It's a smoking gun, I think.
And he's saying that scientists that actually work with Bruce say that there's absolutely no way that he could have done it.
Exactly.
That, of course, has not been reported by the BBC, which is why maybe you're quite right to be outside there banging on their door. After all, if we don't pay the BBC licence fee, we get put in jail.
Yeah.
Or we can do.
Campbell's not paying his. But
has he been jailed
Tony
yet?
Rook. No, you'd be surprised how they're unwilling to create martyrs by sending anybody to jail, actually, on the issue.
Another question that's come up here is from Larry Jarbo, and he's saying, what do you think is the best way to put pressure on TV stations, etc.? He's asking me as well. I would suggest one of the ways you can do it is simply by having personal contacts with journalists. But what seems to be happening right across the Western press, and I mean, this is a whole another subject maybe, but is that honest journalists seem to be being sacked, being gotten rid of when they start to approach this kind of subject and start to try and deal with it.
Oh yeah, I mean, the battlefield's littered with journalists who, I mean, James Whale, you know, is a very aggressive talk show host. I was on one of his shows on TalkSport a few years ago, and you know, he's struggled to, I believe he's struggled to find a home.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Dave Von Kleist, we heard from earlier, he used to be on the old GCN network, which the Alex Jones and InfoWars are still on there. And then there's also George Butler, a guy in Austin, Texas, that does a program called The Secret Truth. He was also on that syndicated GCN network. As soon as he started to, he actually did an interview with Miko Peled, who was the son of one of the Israeli generals who were being very critical of the Israeli-US policy in the Middle East. all of a sudden he's told, well, sorry, your show is just boring, we're going to have to get rid of it now. But anyway, moving on to...
Well, when David Ray Griffin, I mean, this was spectacular, actually, because finally CNN were prepared to broach this. It had come up on their entertainment section, and they were overwhelmed by 9/11 skepticism when they raised it. And then they went stone dead on it 3 days later, and the executives said they'd been ordered to stop talking about it. Well, then they had their one of their controversial panelist type people, hosts, called David Ray Griffin in, and literally she was sacked that day. They literally stopped it at about 48 hours notice, and they just to stop David Ray Griffin getting onto mainstream TV. That's how nervous they are.
Well, it reminds me of Discovery Channel and Conspiracy of Silence, which was a film made by Tim Tate, who's a British a documentary producer, about paedophile rings in the United States and in Washington, and the Republican Party, rather similar to our whole VI paedophile scandal. They actually paid $500,000 for the film, and then at the end of the day, they never showed it. But Martin, anyway, let's move on to Martin. What are your maybe three or four main points?
Okay. Well, we've covered one of them earlier, which is the WTC7 building. Most people don't realise that three buildings collapsed, and that building was not hit by a plane. It wasn't. There was no plane fire. So that's the first point. The second point I'd like to say to people is this. Where was the United States Air Force for several hours on that day? Well, they had exercises.
But apparently, I mean, exercises.
Well, but don't forget, in the Battle of Britain, when in the 1940s, it took, you know, what, 30 minutes for the RAF to get airborne?
Quite a lot less than that. About five minutes.
Well, exactly.
Minutes, yeah.
So where was the Air Force? And, of course, we've never been given a satisfactory explanation for that. We know what happened. They were given a stand-down order.
Those planes were flying around for an hour and three quarters, weren't they?
Yes, exactly. Now, that's so those two. And the third point, I think of the context. And I'll just mention one word in terms of context. Gladio, G-L-A-D-I-O. You can just put it into any search engine and it will come up. And, of course, there is overwhelming evidence put together by the Italian police force, by the Belgian police force, by Swiss academics, nobody really disputes this as a historian, that NATO intelligence services were involved in exactly this kind of false flag terrorism in the 40s, 50s and 60s in Western Europe, including the Brabant massacres in Belgium, where people in supermarkets were shot at random, and also bombing the Bologna railway station in 1980, the kidnap of Aldo Moro, the Prime Minister of Italy, all according to the Italian police force and 30 years of investigation carried out by NATO intelligence services.
Area. I mean, of course, Hitler's invasion of Poland was based on the allegation that Poland was invading Germany.
I was in Dresden last year, and there are still Germans who believe that. They
really?
Still believe that Poland did invade. And actually, it was reported in the New York Times that Poland had invaded Germany.
Was it really?
Do you want to just talk about that incident, that Gleiwitz incident?
They took Polish concentration camp victims,
didn't they? People who were in concentration camps who were Polish, dressed them up in stolen Polish army uniforms, and then gave them lethal injections, and then photographed them, and those photographs went around the world.
Yeah, and said that the Poles had attacked the German border post, and therefore they had to respond.
Now, amazingly enough, some actually survived the lethal injections as well. There were one or two that actually survived during the war and spoke briefly after the end of World War II.
Well, in actual fact, that's quite an interesting line of inquiry, because this kind of fascist psychological warfare technique, which is what we're really talking about now, psychological warfare in 1939 was pretty crude. Yeah, I mean, nobody really believed, apart from the German propaganda machine, that the Poles had invaded, had attacked Germany.
Well, no, and we don't believe today, do we, that Saddam had weapons of mass destruction?
Well, no,
we had two million people didn't believe. They went out on the streets of London.
Well, that's right. But, of course, what actually happened at the end of World War II is a lot of the fascist intelligence personnel were recruited by the OSS, which became the CIA, and recruited into NATO. So Reinhard Gehlen, who used to head up the Gestapo in Eastern Europe and had loads of agents operating inside the Soviet Union, he became the head of the West German intelligence services. And if I was head of the KGB, that would be a pretty clear signal to me about what's going on here.
There's been a couple of scandals recently in Germany in the last 10 years, actually twice now. The German Bundesnachrichtendienst, BND, have been caught setting up fascist cells And, you know, some of the key fascist right-wing, extreme right-wing organisers in Germany are beyond any doubt, you know, basically agents of the BND. It's been admitted.
I mean, we could actually at this point bring in some of the stories over the last couple of months to do with fascists in Germany and in Britain, because we've had the arrest in Germany of, this is, I think, just within the last week, of police who they say in Germany were fascists and were planning to assassinate left-wing leaders in Germany. We've also had the army lieutenant, Martin, I think we covered this story on this show, didn't we? German, who had left a false trail as a Syrian refugee and was planning to blow up a bomb in Vienna airport. More recently, we've also had, just over the last couple of weeks, arrests in Britain or in the British Army by West Midlands police of what they believe are far-right extremists in a banned organisation here in Britain.
Well, also here in Britain, the bombings of Bologna, we mentioned Bologna railway station earlier, I did, in 1972, Dublin and Monaghan were bombed by loyalist terrorists in Ireland, killed 27 people, injured hundreds more. Simultaneous bombs in both Dublin and Monaghan in the rush hour as people were going home from work. And the Justice Henry Barron, who's the head of the Irish Supreme Court, has written a report called The Barron Report on this attack, which points the finger very, very firmly at British intelligence for being behind those bombings. Now, in other words, there is a track record of British, US, Israeli intelligence service, and they're, of course, they're not the only ones. This kind of false flag terrorism, you know, creating something shocking and outrageous so that you can then herd everybody like sheep in the direction you want them to go, is a tactic that's actually as old as warfare itself. But of course, modern psychological warfare is very, very sophisticated.
Okay, I think the key point about 9/11 from the psychological warfare point of view is that it was such a big event. And so, you know, paradoxically, people will say, well, I don't think they'd do anything that big.
That's right.
But actually, it works much better if it's big. Look at Oklahoma,
called Audacity or Chutzpah?
Chutzpah, I think, yeah.
Well, if it's a big enough lie, isn't it a big enough lie you might be more likely to get away?
Because it's more frightening to think that they're doing this on that scale than that they would do it just on maybe a small scale just to justify
something. Fascinating, I think over the last few weeks we've seen these arrests of fascists within the system, within the police and within the army. German soldier arrested, planned false flag terror attack on Vienna airport. That refugees would take the blame. Neo-Nazi arrests. Four alleged members of National Action were arrested over terrorism. That's West Midlands Police. Commission preparation and instigation of acts of terror within the British Army.
Yeah, and you've got to remember that if you look at the history of Operation Gladio in Western Europe, the intelligence services were running all sorts of different kinds of terrorism. So it was fascist operatives who'd actually bombed Bologna railway station, but it was the Red Brigades who'd supposedly kidnapped Aldo Moro, the Prime Minister, although in fact both organisations, the fascists and the Red Brigades, were being manipulated by Caesar.
Now, in the attacks that happened here in Britain before the general election, many of the people had been reported to the anti-terror hotline. It seems here that actually the police themselves, the ordinary West Midlands police, we're not talking about MI5 here, are a bit of a different quantity to the Secret Services.
Well, the West Midlands police put a Swedish national on trial at the Old Bailey some years ago now, a couple of years ago now, because he was about to go off to Syria to join ISIS. And his defence lawyers argued perfectly successfully that in actual fact he was working with MI6, and MI6 were working with the groups that he was going to join, and so he was released. So in other words, there's a tension there between policing and the intelligence services. And if there are any police officers listening to this show, I would suggest to them that it's your job as the independent police force.
Or firefighters.
Well, firefighters can't go around arresting people.
No.
In Colombia a few years ago, there was something called Operation Dragon, which was orchestrated by the military high command, and they planned to assassinate all the trade union leaders, the main trade union leaders in Colombia, over a two-week period. And just before they were about to do that, the Colombian National Police raided army headquarters and took away loads of information.
Okay, I'll put a link
and therefore thwarted it.
I'll put a link up to this most recent story about the British police arresting far-right British Army people, allegedly anyway, during a trip to the Buchenwald concentration camp in Germany last year. Masked members of this banned group displayed their flag and performed Hitler salutes in what they called an execution room. National Action describes itself as a National Socialist youth organisation, was known for using the phrases Hitler was right and Britain is ours, the rest must go, at marches and online. It used social media to call for a white jihad.
Yeah, but what may be happening here is both the jihadis and the fascists are in fact straw organisations,
yeah,
which are being manipulated by the intelligence services. There's plenty of nutty people out there.
I thought it was rather odd the way that, what was that UK group called recently, you know, that was disbanded and collapsed, and it turned out that the guy running it, who'd been interviewed on Newsnight, they got a lot of help from Newsnight, they came from nowhere, Newsnight selected them out of nowhere, and then the guy turned out to be a militant Zionist, which and resigned. He was sort of exposed because, you know, obviously he wasn't pretending to be that.
Well, something called the Quilliam Foundation I found fascinating, which Tommy Robinson, former founder of the EDL, joined. This is a sort of almost a fake Islamic pressure group, Martin.
Yeah, but
saying,
there is a
reasonable side to Islam, and it's us.
Yeah,
the BBC put these people out as if they represent.
You've got to think about the way the intelligence services operate. So they've got extreme right wingers to frighten the Muslims and the liberals. They've got extreme Muslims on the payroll to frighten to frighten everybody else. And of course, they've also then got the moderates who are then going to say this is all wrong, and they're also on the payroll,
yeah,
because we're actually in a completely manipulated reality. But one of the problems they've got in the modern era is the internet, because anybody who disputes anything we've said in the 2 hours of this programme can go away and immediately check it. Immediately. It's quite straightforward. You just have to get your phone out and you can do it. In the past, you couldn't do that. Could go on for ages and ages, and it would you'd have to go and to dig up the relevant documents would take for ages, take forever.
I read an interesting quote in The Independent when I was doing my 9/11 research about Ireland. They spoke to somebody who had been a British Army informant, and he said the attitude was, if there's anything happening, we want to own it. You know, that was the phrase.
That's right.
They wanted to own everything. And I think that's what you're saying, really. Martin.
Okay. One of the things
divide and rule.
One of the things I'd like to do is go back to one of the people who's made a big difference, as far as I can see, in explaining this to people who managed to find the time to go online and look at these things. Is this guy called Webster Tarpley? His How to Stop World War III talk, I think, was around about the same time, around about 2003, 2004. Here's a little extract from it, because he explains that if you have a quite close look at the 9/11 attacks, very much like the JFK assassination, you'll find the person that they're saying did it can't possibly have done it.
Can Lee Harvey Oswald, using the Mannlicher Carcano 1917 rifle, successfully fire the requisite number of shots with bolt action in the time that he has? No. And it doesn't depend on his criminal intent. He can have all the criminal intent in the world. It won't let him do it. And these guys, you can say, oh, they hate us. Oh, they hate us. Doesn't matter how much they hate you. They can't do it. Okay, so this is a whole world of provocateurs, double agents. This is sort of the wormy underside of FBI, CIA, NSA, the rest of them.
And what Webster Tarby is saying here is that they didn't have enough flying training.
Network. This is important. They don't follow the chain of command, even. They're not certainly not loyal to a constitution, but they're rather loyal to a clique. It's ultimately in Wall Street, but it's also senior government officials, generals, and people like this. Those are the moles. They also have to organize the cover-up. The moles have to make sure that nobody interferes with the patsies before the fact. Not because the patsies are going to carry out the attack, but because if the patsies are already in jail, you can't blame the crime on the patsies. So they've got to stay free, and then they've got to be arrested immediately, and you've then got to have a cover-up. And then you have professional killers. There's got to be a role in this for, I believe, a privatized command center. There's got to be a role for assassins, in other words, people like the people who really killed Kennedy, coming into town, getting out of town. Patsies love attention. They love to get on TV. Again, Oswald gets on TV, gets on the radio, gets noticed. Atta, same thing, right? Always fighting with people, abrasive. Then the professional killers, who don't say anything, they come in, shoot, leave. They're not ideologues in the same sense. They're not interested in popping off in public. A privatized command center, certainly not Dick Cheney. Can you imagine you're going to have this whole operation, you're going to make it depend on a guy who's 4 heart attacks and 3 pacemakers, sitting there with his wife who keeps turning the CNN up so you can't hear the interagency task force talking? And the whole thing doesn't work without the brainwashed world of the controlled corporate media. Okay? And that's state-sponsored false flag terrorism, because the thing says we're Al-Qaeda, and they're not Al-Qaeda. They're a branch of CIA and MI6.
Well, Webster Tarpley, of course, is a very senior academic. He's got loads of degrees.
But he's also, he cut his teeth over in Italy, didn't he?
He was in Italy during the 70s, during the Gladio era. That's quite correct. And, of course, those who don't understand history don't really understand what's going on. And
you did a talk, didn't you? Well, gosh, must be around about 2005 or so, which we called False Flag Fever, where you talked about 9/11, but you never actually mentioned the 9/11 attacks at all.
That's right, because there's plenty of other evidence that this sort of thing goes on. So before you come to 9/11 and go, they wouldn't do something like that, you've got to take into account all the things that I've been stressing. The Bologna bombing, the bombings in Dublin and Monaghan in 1972, the Brabant massacres in Belgium in the 1980s. All of this stuff has been investigated and proven. But of course, nobody's ever put on trial, nobody ever goes to prison apart from small fry, and so on. And we don't have a state of laws. We have got effectively a fascist dictatorship, but with a democratic facade.
Well, and it's running under a state of emergency.
That's right. And France is currently under a state of emergency after the Charlie Hebdo. So permanent states of emergency. That is the goal here.
There's a huge
gulag of people where the habeas corpus and Magna Carta is out of the window, and hundreds of people are being held in these secret prisons which are not even allowed to know where they are or what goes on in those prisons.
Isn't that exactly what these Islamists were supposed to want? That they hate our freedoms, they want us to take them up, to take our freedoms away?
Well, it's worse than that, because, I mean, the mainstream left, as it were, say, well, the Muslims are getting fed up because they're being attacked and bullied. And in one sense, they're right. But in actual fact, the most extreme Sunni jihadists are trained by our people. Saudi Arabia is our ally. British military personnel are currently in Saudi Arabia helping them target Houthi rebels inside Yemen. In other words, we are complicit in everything that the Saudis do, and the Saudis are the heartland of Wahhabi extremism. If we were going to go anywhere to invade after 9/11, that surely should have been the place.
Are the Saudis actually allied with the Israelis?
Yes, they are. The Israelis and the Saudis are allied. I mean, in Syria, they are on the same side. That's exactly what's been going on for a long time.
And but of it course, was raised, actually, in the media. It actually came out on the sort of gossipy parts of the political media that they were sort of quasi-publicly admitting this.
Yes, it's pretty much well known to everybody. But of course, out there in the sort of normal society, people think, but surely the Saudis hate the Israelis and the Israelis hate the Saudis. You say, no, they don't. And in actual fact, when there was attempted to remove Prince Salman recently, the Israelis sent aircraft to Saudi Arabia to support him. And of course, they may use Saudi Arabia as a base to attack Iran.
Well, they're already talking about potentially getting involved in Syria, aren't they? The Israelis just the last week.
Well, they did it. They carried out a bombing raid yesterday. What they claimed was a chemical weapons factory, but of course the Syrians deny that. I mean, on what basis are they allowed to do that? Well, they're not really supposed to do that at all. The war's already raging. People are dying
every
day.
One of the more interesting, I mean, I spoke to writer Soraya Sepafor Ulrich a couple of years ago, and she pointed out that many of these security companies are actually owned by Israeli companies and Israeli firms.
Well, that's why I mentioned that earlier. The whole privatisation of security, the Israelis present themselves, say, oh, we're the experts on fighting Islamist terrorism, so you need us. So they end up running ICTS, running the various airports, and of course, Verint Systems, which is another Israeli-linked, Mossad-linked company, they control the CCTV on the London Underground.
Well, anyway, let's go over to the United States and have a reminder now of what Soraya Sepafor Ulrich had to say to me a couple of years ago.
Israel conducts U.S. foreign policy. I mean, the most prominent scholars have said that Israeli, like Mearsheimer and Walt, they've said that Israel shapes U.S. foreign policy. You only have to look at the Israeli lobby groups, AIPAC being the most powerful, but then AIPAC is the muscle. It doesn't formulate ideas. It's all the pro-Israeli think tanks in the United States that come up with these policy papers, and then they're implemented by whichever administration happens to be in office. And AIPAC is the muscle, you know, says, you know, you have to do this, and we'll buy you or we don't buy you. But also another thing that's very frightening, I think, about the United States, and very few people even give it a second thought, is all the security in the United States is run by Israeli governments, including FBI, including water treatment plants, including the nuclear sites, including the airports. And the danger of having Israeli firms in charge of all these securities is just beyond anybody's imagination. So even if AIPAC were to pull back and say, okay, I'm a foreign agent, I won't interfere, there's still this problem with the security of the United States being in the hands of Israeli firms. And so Israel's power over America is not just in the fact that they can buy politicians. It's a lot more complex than that, and a lot more threatening to the country.
Empire, aren't we? And I mean, I think you might have made this case for South Africa. You know, people would have said, well, South Africa is controlling Britain, you know, before, you know, the collapse of apartheid, when we were supporting the apartheid state in South Africa. But I think the way the empire works is that they have a sort of lead country for each part of the globe, and Israel's the lead country for the Middle East.
But how do you explain all these links from Israeli software companies and security companies?
Well, the whole thing, lots of things. There's millions of links. Everybody's linked to everybody else. It's quite easy to find links. I think she's slightly exaggerated there, to be honest.
Well, she's saying that the security companies that are in charge of major sites often the Israelis win those contracts.
I would agree with that, but I think she said something a little bit more than that, a little bit more total.
Well, she's also saying that the Israelis, to a large extent, control much of the U.S. foreign policy. Martin, what do you think?
Well, what about Ukraine? I mean, we've had fascists. We put fascists into power in Ukraine. I don't think Israel was terribly happy about that.
No, that's not true. Kolomoisky in Ukraine is a very interesting character. He's Jewish, and he's an oligarch. And he's aligned with Svoboda, which is the which are the fascists. So in actual fact, and of course we've covered on other shows that we've done, Tony, the links between Martin Bormann, who probably escaped from Berlin with British help at the end of the war, and when he set up his front organisations in Latin America, he made very sure to have lots and lots of Jewish people involved. So the idea that Jews can't be fascists, I'm afraid, is just wrong.
Oh, totally.
Right wingers. Hate.
Well, Einstein himself Einstein himself compared the Zionists to fascists. He turned down the offer of becoming president of Israel. But let's be clear here, there's a few different things. We don't want to mix them up. There's Jewish people, there's Israel, there's Zionists, there's anti-Zionists. You can have any combination of that. So I think, you know, when we say Israel, we need to be just a little bit careful about exactly what
we are talking about. The state of Israel.
Let's remember one more.
The state.
Let's remember one more thing about. Sorry, I've lost my thread there. So I'll come back to it.
Okay. I'd also like to talk, because I did speak a couple of weeks ago to a guy called Manfred Petrisch. He runs a blog in German language called All Smoke and Mirrors. He's a former Swiss banker, and also he was born to a German family in Argentina just after World War II. I think I'll leave it at that. He's now moved to the Black Sea, to Abkhazia. He's had enough of the West, and he has, I think, quite an interesting take on how the police state has started to, because we're starting to touch on some of those elements there, and the way civil liberties have been being destroyed since the September 11th attacks. And this is really, I mean, he just wasn't born in Germany, but this is really a German point of view.
Every time there is a terror attack, they want to have more competence regarding watching us and listening to us and destroying all the freedoms and the constitutional rights. And every time, and then when they have more competence, still there is a terror attack, and then they ask for more. So what is happening is, in the last 16 years, they have asked for more and more and more police power to invade your home, to listen to what you're doing, to store all your communications on the internet and the telephone and the mobile phone and all these things. And still there are terror attacks happening, which means that it's not about fighting terrorism. It never was. This is just an excuse for the stupid people.
Yeah.
It's what Orwell wrote in his book, 1984. It is the complete controlled state, the big brother watching you. He predicted it all, and we have it all now. And we have even more than he predicted. It's all heading into the so-called world government, which means that there is only one European government in the form of EU. That's a step in between to the big union, which will be a world government. That's what they want to achieve. They want to have just one government that controls everything, world domination. It has always been, if you go back thousands of years, it has always been the aim of emperors and kings and dictators and whatever to control the whole world. That's always been their aim.
I think it was a James Bond film, Dr. No, wasn't it, where James Bond himself says, oh, world domination, the same old dream.
Exactly. And that's what they're trying to achieve through different means, by doing all this North American Union and European Union and Asian Union and African Union. In the end, what they do, they join all these unions together and they will have the World Union. There has been a huge concentration of corporations. They have become monsters. They have become so big that they are bigger than countries. I mean, if you look at the balance sheet of these big corporations, they're bigger than the budget of many countries. They are above countries, and that's why they introduce globalism. Globalism only helps the huge world corporations, because then they can install their factories where they have the cheapest labor. They can install their headquarters in the place where they have the lowest tax. They can install their research department in that country which has the most lax environment laws. So they are the profiters of the globalism. You and I, we don't profit. And also the middle and small business don't profit from globalism. Only the big corporations. And they dictate all the laws to the governments. And this is, you can see this in the EU. The EU was only formed so that the big corporations can sell all their stuff into one big market of 500 million people. That's why it was created. Because then before, they had to have abide by the French law and the German law and the Italian law and the British law, and they had to do all these different changes. So what they said is, hey, we are sick and tired of this. Let's get rid of all this stuff and just have one big union, and then we can just sell the same stuff to everybody.
Okay, but how do we stop this globalism? Assuming that this is a kind of totalitarian system that's gathering force here, is there any way to stop it?
Well, you did it with Brexit. And that was the biggest kick in the groin for the globalists that anybody ever did. That's why I congratulate the British people that they voted for the Brexit. This is great. You see, what has to happen is all the countries have to regain their sovereignty. They have to regain control over their borders, regain control over their financial system, regain control about all the laws, and not be dictated from an unelected apparatchik in Brussels who dictates what you have to do. I mean, these people in Brussels, nobody has ever elected anybody of those. You cannot elect the head of the European Commission. You cannot elect the president of the Commission. You cannot select any of the Commission members. So, well, where is there democracy in the EU? There is none. This is actually a copy of the Soviet Union, of the UdSSR. The EU is a copy of that.
Well, that's one view anyway. That's Manfred Petrich from All Smoke and Mirrors. And he's really saying there, effectively, Martin, that the 9/11 attacks are part of a wider attempt at globalism and world domination. Is that too far-fetched?
No, it's not. But you've got to remember that, in actual fact, the Russians and the Chinese aren't in on this game, which is why they're being forced.
Well, one of the things he said, which I haven't put on here tonight, is that the only reason we're not in World War III now is because of Putin.
Well, the Russians and the Russians have managed to rebuild their state as a democratic state, relatively speaking, and their armed forces. When I used to go over there in the 1990s, the place was in freefall. Absolute freefall. And of course, Putin, when he first came to power, through false flag terrorism, possibly, is a big topic that we could go into there about the bombs in Moscow and Ryazan. But he's double-crossed his backers, and he's trying to build up a Russian power, which is not controlled by international corporations. So, for example, they've still got a nationalised railway, nationalised oil industry, etc., all of which has got to go as far as Western corporations are concerned. But they are not able to have everything their way. The idea that they are completely in control and that they're manipulating everything.
Oh, no,
they are very evil.
Definitely not.
But they don't necessarily. Warfare is a very, very risky business.
Sort of traditional empire in a way, and I think it's mainly centred on Washington. Washington and London, maybe at Tel Aviv.
And Tel Aviv, yeah.
You know, and Brussels.
Anyway, I thought we'd finish up with listening to Sybil Edmonds talking about ISIS, because this is one of the things that seems to have spun out of the 9/11 attacks and all the focus on the Middle East is the growth of ISIS. She's a former FBI translator, Turkish translator turned whistleblower. So anyone that thinks there aren't enough whistleblowers around, well, they have not been listening to this show, have they?
If I can speak for the people here in the United States, first of all, for them it's easy to digest, and most people here have been systematically stripped off of their critical thinking ability. They just want some sound bites from the mainstream media. They want sound bites from their TV news. I mean, it's really blurry, the difference between fiction-based sitcoms and what you watch on these types of news with, let's say, CBS or NBC. Mm-hmm. It's very, very blurry, and they work hand in hand, and they accept it. And then we have to admit, they have created, especially since 9/11, an entire industry, you know, from intelligence complex to military industrial complex, as I said, contractors, subcontractors. You are looking at domestically, at least here in the United States, in trillions of dollars. And then if you start going outward and internationally in terms of gaining dominance in the region, and whether it's with Iraq and Syria and the Middle East, or what's going to come, and it has been at work in Central Asia, Ukraine kind of quieted down, but we actually got what we wanted to get out of that. Next, we are going to see, and that's my prediction, we are going to see some unrest in Georgia, because there are going to be these so-called terror events that are going to be blamed on some ferocious Chechen faction that may be collaborating with ISIS faction, and that's going to lead to Georgia's becoming formally, officially accepted into NATO as a member. We already have troops in Georgia. It's already on its way.
That was former FBI whistleblower Sybil Edmonds there. She's talked, Martin, about, for example, about a kind of almost a prison where ISIS is this thing you've just got to believe in and you can't get out of it.
Well, Rita Katz's website tells us all about ISIS, and of course she, what's it called? Searching for
international terrorist entities.
Yes, searching internet for terrorist entities. Most ISIS PR seems to come through her, even though she's a definitely an ex-Israeli intelligence agent. In terms of what we can do to try and do anything about this, I think we've got to make demands of the police and the intelligence services. And we've said some pretty harsh things about the intelligence services here. They're not to be trusted. And when the police are investigating the events that we've seen, for example, recently in Britain, one of the things that they should be bearing in mind is the role of the intelligence services in terrorist attacks. It's not crazy. It's perfectly straightforward, as Justice Henry Barron pointed out about the 1972 attacks in Dublin and Monaghan. The Garda Síochána investigated it, they looked into it, they pointed the finger at MI6. When Imposimato in the in Italy investigated what was going on there, he wrote a book, La Repubblica dei Stragi Impuni, The Republic of the Unpunished Massacres, that came out in 2012. The police have got to do their job.
Well, I'd also add the fire brigades, you know, because the fire people, they lost 300 people in 9/11, and there is a lot of debate going on in the fire brigades union now. So if you do know anybody who's a fireman, a firefighter...
Anybody who knows a fireman, let them have a listen to the sound, the voices of the fire brigade in New York just before
Bravo
the buildings
7.
Came down.
There's a video being shown on Sunday, actually, about search Bravo 7 and you'll find it.
Absolutely shocking that they said, well, we pretty much put the fire out, and then all of a sudden a massive explosion and they're all died in a controlled demolition.
Yeah, they were halfway up. They were reporting that it was safe to go up because it probably was before the demolition went
on. So your book is 9/11 the New Evidence.
9/11 the New Evidence, Ian Henshall. Reinvestigate911.org is our website. Facebook? I'm not a huge believer in Facebook, but we do have a Facebook page.
Well, a lot of people, particularly young people, they don't watch television anymore. They're getting all their info from social media. So
yeah.
It's kind of, you know, we're almost in a straitjacket, aren't we, with Facebook?
But what you can do is to give people your email, give trusted people your email, because if I email you, it'll get through. If I put a Facebook post out, it probably won't. The picture of the head of the CIA unit who should have stopped 9/11, I put that on Facebook. It got 24 people looked at it, so-called. When I mentioned Chomsky, it goes to 1,000. Facebook is controlled. Really, obviously, it is controlled. So please don't trust Facebook. Use it by all means, but don't trust it.
Good tip. Thanks
very
much.
Go on an email list. Much more likely to get...
Finally, any thoughts about the next night, big 9/11, or even bigger this time, Martin? Any thoughts on that?
Well, one of the things we're doing by investigating this way, we're trying to deter these criminals. If they do try anything else, we're going to be all over it, and they'd better know that.
Yeah, and the people around them are going to possibly make reports. So, you know, rather than not seeing what might be obvious with hindsight, now it's much more difficult for them because everybody knows about these so-called...
I mean, we're dealing
theories.
Effectively with a kind of failure in law enforcement in the West here,
it's
aren't
a massive failure.
Absolutely.
All through the doctrine of who watches the watchers. Because if you start suggesting that law enforcement should apply to politicians, they're going to start saying, oh, what about the Committee for Public Safety in the French Revolution? They demand the right to be in a crime-free zone. And
anyway,
we can't allow that.
Thanks very much to author of 9/11, The New Evidence, Ian Henshaw, and Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. 2 whole hours on the 16th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, just coming up in a few days' time. This story's show story links and comment page is one word, thisweek.org.uk. Well, I'll put links up to a lot of what we've been talking about tonight, most of the main stuff anyway. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. I'll leave you with music from 1978 and Genesis. Do please join us for a politics show next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, for the 16th anniversary of the events of September the 11th, what questions remain unanswered, which ones may not be asked? We'll take a look at recent research from Dr. David Ray Griffin, his newest book, Bush and Cheney, How They Ruined America and the World. Later in the program, we'll talk about the state of academic freedom surrounding 9/11 research and other controversial issues with Dr. Anthony Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, for the 16th anniversary of the events of September 11th, we look at the recent work of Dr. David Ray Griffin, who has numerous books on the events of September 11th, and his newest book explores the crimes of Bush and Cheney. Later in the program, we'll talk about academic freedom in 9/11 with Dr. Anthony Hall. But first, here's Peter to introduce David Ray Griffin to you. Peter?
David Ray Griffin is a professor emeritus of philosophy of religion and theology at Claremont School of Theology and Claremont Graduate University. He's written many books, one of which is The New Pearl Harbor, but the newest book is Bush and Cheney and How They Ruined America and the World. And that's what we're going to be talking to David about. Hello, David.
Hi, Peter. Hi, Nikki.
It's great to have you here. I read your book this week, and I really enjoyed it because it frames a number of things, including 9/11, as a pivotal point in this century. And you refer to 9/11 and Bush and Cheney, who were in charge at that time of the U.S. government, as a pivot point in terms of our Constitution. You call after 9/11 sort of a post-constitutional era. What do you mean by that?
It's the fact that the Bill of Rights has been pretty much shredded, and that's a term that is widely used now, and that's one of the problems with 9/11 that most people are not aware of. Everybody knows about Afghanistan and Iraq and Libya and Syria, you know, and America and the world. In America, Cheney went through and pretty much shredded the at least some part of the Bill of Rights, and then Obama, he didn't like to do things that were illegal, so he went through and made all the things that Cheney had done legal, at least to, you know, appear to be legal.
That included arresting people, you know, or spying on people without warrants, torturing people, and basically an overall observation of the public without any due process, correct?
That's right. And I must say, that chapter is pretty complex, so it's difficult to discuss on air, at least for me. So on that one, I would hope people would particularly take time to read that chapter, because I think that will surprise them. And as I say at the end of that chapter, you know, the situation has been set for some potential demagogue to come along and take advantage of the shredded Bill of Rights, and then sure enough, we got a potential demagogue, and we don't know how that's going to work out.
Well, David Ray Griffin, I won't mince the words. We have a demagogue, and Bush and Cheney kind of paved the way. Obama worked to normalize what could almost be described as a neoliberal form of soft fascism. And, you know, his attack on the Bill of Rights continued with the NDAA, deportations, the silencing of whistleblowers. And now it's as if it's just unbridled and the mask is taken off. And we just have an amazing degree of hostility toward marginalized communities, toward the global population. This is, you know, writ large, a 1% tyranny. And Donald Trump is, of course, a symptom of this. He's certainly not the mastermind. But talk to us a little more specifically how we got here through the Bush and Cheney regimes, because you detail so many things in your book. We have, of course, the state of emergency after 9/11, the Afghan war that is unending, apparently. We've normalized preemptive war. We've gone through the roof with military spending. We're still in Iraq. We have a crisis of Islamophobia and global chaos. You go through this in great detail. Walk us through a little bit of this and give listeners, again, sort of a teaser for the contents of the book.
Yeah, well, you sort of listed there the chapter headings and the first part of the book. And in fact, let me begin by saying, usually people ask me, why did I write this book? And what happened was I had virtually promised my wife, after I did my 2011 book, that I wouldn't do any more 9/11 books. And then I spent 3 years working on climate change, a big book on that.
You did, and you kept your promise.
For a few years.
That's good.
But about a year and a half ago, I started just seeing just a whole slew of stories in the press pointing out how the world has pretty much self-destructed since 9/11. Now, a lot of people would say since the Iraq War, but others will say really since 9/11, and that's what I say. So I thought, well, I'll make one more effort to break through. And so what I tried to do in my previous book, like my most extensive book on 9/11 was The New Pearl Harbor Revisited, written in 2008. So I go through there and tell almost everything that's wrong with the official story of 9/11. Well, I've learned that, you know, people who haven't lived and breathed this for several years get so lost and it gets so complex, and they say, you know, I just can't write anything. I can't do anything about 9/11. It's too complex. It would take me too long to get up to speed. And so I decided, well, you know, you really don't need to know all those details, and that all you really need to know is the fact that on 9/11, major miracles that occurred, and by a miracle I mean it in the technical sense, that was used by David Hume in the 18th century and is used by physicists now. A miracle is something that is physically and chemically impossible. So, you know, and most of the people in the press, you say, well, do you believe in miracles? Well, of course not. That's, you know, stupid stuff. But what they don't realize is insofar as they endorse this official story, they're endorsing these major miracles that just could not have happened.
You're referring specifically to the collapse of the World Trade Centers and Building 7.
Well, yeah.
As miracles, because...
And Hani Hanjour miracles.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, most of the miracles are with the World Trade Centers, the Twin Towers, and Building 7. And when you look at it, you just see it's just ridiculous to think that anybody's believed this, and yet they so, you know, frightened people. They got people to the point that they wouldn't even look at 9/11. You say, oh, no, I don't go there. And so they won't even look at the fact that they would not believe it if they would do it. It's too scary, and scary in the sense that they pretty well believe. I don't think this is true anymore, but certainly during the Bush-Cheney years, and I think during Obama years, if you really questioned the official story, you'd be quite likely to lose your job and lose your reputation. And a lot of people, most people, just say, well, you know, it's not worth it. I go out on a limb here, and it won't make any difference whatsoever. So I just won't do it, and I'll just keep it to myself. So my strategy in the book was to, first of all, get people to see how much the world has changed and been ruined since 9/11 itself. And then secondly, to see how obviously false the official story is, and then thirdly, hoping that that combination of facts would embolden some people to say, look, we say we defend the Constitution, we defend the United Nations, we want to defend the Earth, and we see now the only way we can do it is by revealing the falsity of the 9/11 official story. And so if I do it on my own, sure, I'll lose my job, I'll lose my reputation, and so on. You know, I won't be interviewed on the Rachel Maddow show. But
or you won't get to go back and see Tucker Carlson.
But if we could get like 50 really solid people whose reputations are such that, you know, it'd be very difficult for anybody to ridicule them as individuals. And certainly, if you got 50 of these people together saying the same thing, it would be very difficult. So this is my hope with the book. And, you know, it's a very long shot, but I thought I had to try.
Well, you identify Bush and Cheney as key to this, certainly right after 9/11, and at least allowing 9/11 to happen, because they had many, many warnings and could have preempted the whole event. But, you know, that danger is certainly there. And
just a minute, let me interrupt. Don't even talk about the possibility that they just let it happen. If you look at the World Trade Center, everything parted. There's no way they could have just let it happen. They caused it to happen. And those are the miracles. They created the miracles.
Okay.
Are you talking Bush and Cheney created the miracles, or subsets of the deep state intelligence world created?
I don't get into the details who did it. But, of course, we know that Cheney knew, you know, a lot of people say, oh, Bush and Cheney, they couldn't have done anything. They were so stupid. Well, yeah, Bush, but not Cheney. Cheney had been the Secretary of Defense, so he knows all about how planes can come in and cause havoc by seeming to be having mistakes. So, yeah, I would say that they were responsible, and, of course, Rumsfeld was in charge of the Pentagon, and he and Cheney, of course, were best friends, and they had worked together in the House as they first got started in politics. So when I say Bush and Cheney, I could have said Bush, Cheney, and Rumsfeld, but then I could have also added, you know, the leading Secretary of Defense at the time.
For New American Century. Yeah, all the players you know.
So if you're going to, you know, you could have a very long title for the book.
Yeah.
So I just say Bush and Cheney.
Well, Bush and Cheney and how they ruined the world, which they did. And, you know, certainly their involvement and awareness of 9/11 is crystal clear to me and many others in this country. And the Mineta testimony around Cheney and the bunker at the White House and all of that is certainly suspect. But, you know, more importantly, and I think
Let me focus in on that issue, because, you know, what they did is Cheney went down to the underground bunker, the PIOC, a little before 9:30. And then they start getting frightened that, you know, they're going to think Cheney, having been in the PIOC and being in charge, might have been responsible for the attack on the Pentagon. And then there was also the problem with the plane going to Pennsylvania. And so they just changed the time and said that Cheney did not get into the PIOC until 9:57 or 9:58. So everything had already happened, so there was no way that Cheney could have been responsible for these things. Who knows where he was? He was somehow wandering around the White House. And that's what the 9/11 Commission did, and that's what they did. And that became the official story, and hardly anybody knows about the Mineta story, because it couldn't have happened because Cheney wasn't down there.
David, what is PEOC? Tell our listeners.
Presidential Emergency Operations Center.
Okay.
Just known as the bunker.
Right. I'd like to remind listeners, this is the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Hove with Peter Phillips. We're speaking right now with Dr. David Ray Griffin. His most recent book, Bush and Cheney, How They Ruined America and the World. We'll continue our conversation with David Ray Griffin after this brief musical break. Please stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's show, for the 16th anniversary of the events of 9/11, we're joined by scholar Dr. David Ray Griffin, author of over 10 books on 9/11, including his newest, Bush and Cheney, How They Ruined America and the World. Before the break, David, you were talking about the Normanetta testimony, but and how the 9/11 Commission, edited by Philip Zelikow, who wrote works with Condoleezza Rice at Project for New American Century, and all the connections these people have behind the scenes. But I wanted to go back to that, if you wanted to finish the story with Mineta and how the commission made it such that his testimony under oath couldn't be true.
Well, that's right. So the press have just accepted that official story. And if you tell people, you know, it's not true. I mean, there's all the evidence that Cheney was down there before 9:30, and therefore 10 or more minutes before the attack on the Pentagon. And the Mineta story, there was about a young man who would keep coming into the PIOC and saying, you know, the plane is getting closer, and he'd come back again, and now it's getting closer, and finally, it's, you know, very close. Do the orders still stand? And Cheney said, well, of course. Hey, you know, have you heard anything to the contrary? So it seems like the order clearly was to stand down. Well, that was very problematic for that to become public, because here was Mineta on public television, and there's no way they could stop him from telling that story. And so they had to figure out how to clean it up. Well, now we have proof that, you know, the Mineta story was true, and that the 9/11 Commission told a big lie, because we have three separate statements by members of the Secret Service saying that, here's one of them, it says Danny Spriggs, the Secret Service assistant, got down to the PIOC at 9:30, and he said, presidential and vice presidential staff and Cheney and Condoleezza Rice were already there. And then there's a couple other statements like that. So now there is no doubt, and if you had a press that would, you know, dig into this like they dig into stories about Trump or stories about almost anything else, this would be an obvious one to do, because if Cheney and the 9/11 Commission lied in something that is provably a lie, then that throws the whole 9/11 theory into question. But, of course, we do not have that kind of press.
Well, David, after 16 years, it seems pretty clear to me and Mickey that the corporate media is not going to examine this. They'll continue to say that we're crazy conspiracy theorists to even think about these issues, and that's part of the problem. But your book is even broader than just that. I mean, part two is all the miraculous things that happened, and I love that section. But, you know, in part one, you're really laying out how the world has changed, that our Constitution has been shredded, that the concept of a unitary presidency, a president with power to engage in preemptive wars, that is, we can invade countries as a preemptive act. And this is a really an important piece, because one of the stories of Project Censored this year is that the United States special operations are killing people in over 140 countries in the world. So, I mean, we are the military global empire in NATO. Along with us, that has been allowed to expand worldwide because of 9/11. In fact, Trump's speech on his extended war in Afghanistan talked about 9/11. He mentioned that at least a half a dozen times. So it's still the justification. So talk about what we've lost as a society in that capacity.
Well, you know, I mean, so many, in many respects, one is that, you know, we've never had a perfect press. They already covered up the Kennedy assassination, for example. In fact, both Kennedy assassinations, where they were obviously, the official story was false, even more obviously with Bobby. You got him allegedly shot from the front, and yet all the bullets go into his back. And the press covered that up. So for a long time, we've had that kind of press, but it's gotten even much worse now, where it's just very difficult. So, you know, people get mad at Trump for talking about fake news. And it is problematic, because he generally talks about stuff as fake news that's critical of him. But there is, as you know, so much of the mainstream news is fake news to some degree or another. So there's that problem. There's the problem of the reputation of the United States. Another book that I've been working on is sort of a prequel to this, is, you know, the history of the American empire, raising the question, is America, you know, blessed or cursed? Is it something to be proud of, or is it as we like to say, God-inspired, or is it more demonic? And I was sort of surprised even to see that a large number of people now say American Empire is evil, and that it is the major source of evil in the world, in the international relations.
So, David Ray Griffin, the aftermath of 9/11 certainly is what you're looking at in your latest book, specifically through the lens of Bush and Cheney. And just to wrap this segment here, just a final question for you. I'm assuming I know the answer to this, but what do you hope that you're going to accomplish here with your latest work on 9/11?
Well, I already said that I would hope that some real patriots who have impeccable reputation would get together and say, look, let's join forces here and try to do what we can to save the nation and save the world by revealing this enormous lie about 9/11. One other point I want to make clear is, although Bush and Cheney are in the title, it's really a book about the neocons. And so there's a lot about Hillary Clinton. Of course, when I wrote this book, I thought she was going to become the president, and she was threatening to go in and totally take out Assad in Syria. She even wants to bring about regime change in Russia, and, you know, they would frown on that with their nuclear weapons. You know, it's just become such a frightening world. And then we say, well, you know, Trump's really bad, and let's get rid of him, and he really is bad. But when you get rid of Trump, you bring in Pence, and he's a neocon. So whether you had Hillary or you get Pence, you get the neocons back in charge.
Well, essentially, you're saying that the neocons have been around since Bush the First in many capacities, and that is reflective of where our government is today. That you know, and that we're in danger, and it's a danger of not only ecological holocaust, which is one of your chapters, but a nuclear holocaust as well. And now we have someone in power in the presidency who is not only influenced by the neocons, but is capable of initiating warfare that could lead to nuclear exchanges. So we're very concerned about all this, and we certainly applaud your work here. It's very important work. The book is called Bush and Cheney, How They Ruined America and the World, just out by David Ray Griffin from Olive Branch Press. We highly recommend it. And, David, thank you so much for being on with us.
Thanks, guys.
Really appreciate it.
Thank you, David. I'd like to remind listeners that this is the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. After this brief musical break, we'll return to our 16th anniversary program about the events of 9/11. We'll be speaking with Dr. Anthony Hall about academic freedom surrounding 9/11 and other controversial issues. Please stay with us.
Our jets in a terror hijack. They flew into the towers with a mighty impact. The Trade Center fell in total collapse. Now Bush is in the classroom for a photo op show. The story of the goat is what he once gets to know. The day is 9/11, year 2001. Now who the hell's attacking us? What's to be done? Do the orders still stand, sir? Do the orders still stand?
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, for the 16th anniversary of the events of September 11th, we're looking at what questions remain unanswered, which ones may not be asked. And in this segment, we're joined by Professor Tony Hall. He is a co-anchor and a researcher. Tony Hall is a full-tenured professor of globalization studies at the University of Lethbridge in Alberta, Canada. He's worked there for 25 years, during which time he's published articles in many venues, including Globe and Mail, Toronto Star, Ottawa Citizen, also the Dictionary of Canadian Biography, Literary Review of Canada, so many more. And he also has made many presentations to the Canadian parliamentary committees and served as an expert witness on constitutional issues on legal cases in Canada and the United States. He also is author of The American Empire and the Fourth World, as well as Earth into Property, Colonization, Decolonization, and Capitalism, both by McGill Queen's University Press. He also has a program with Dr. Kevin Barrett, and it is a show, False Flag Weekly News. Tony Hall, welcome back to the Project Censored Show. It's been a while.
Yeah, hi.
Thanks so much for joining us in the program today, Tony. And I know we have some serious issues to discuss regarding academic freedom and things that have been happening with you this past year. But as a segue into that, and we want you to tell that story, tell us about, again, how you got involved in 9/11 research. And that's, of course, where we originally met and had you on the program.
Yeah, I was pressured by my friend and colleague, John Boncourt, sometimes called Splitting the Sky, Dakajawea, a Mohawk activist. And we had worked together on various issues. And in 2008, he said, Tony, you've got to get off the fence on 9/11. And I had looked at it as a blowback, and I'd written about it in one of my big volumes, The American Empire and the Fourth World, as blowback. Anyway, he came and spoke in my class, and I brought myself up to speed, and my gosh, the evidence of what really happened does not conform with the official story, no doubt about it. Splitting the Sky went on the subsequent year to attempt the citizen's arrest of George W. Bush in Calgary, Alberta, a credibly accused war criminal, of course. So that became an interesting basis of collaboration, including with Dr. Kevin Barrett, with whom I currently work as co-host on False Flag Weekly News, and we found a lot in common. Dr. Barrett lost his job at the University of Wisconsin in 2006 for insisting on doing his job in his Islamic studies class and looking at 9/11 and its effects on Islamic people, Muslim people. So I took it up as a research subject and began to teach about it and research about it and write about it and come to Berkeley and speak with you and Peter and hello, Peter. And increasingly, I sort of found that it was necessary to go beyond the kind of analysis of what happened on that day in terms of sort of a physical description. You inevitably start getting interested in the idea, well, if it wasn't the people named Islamic terrorists acting independently with box cutters and such, somebody did it. And who did it? And, of course, that leads into perilous waters, I suppose, the question of starting to speculate about who actually did do it.
Tony, hi. This is Peter Phillips. Give us, in a nutshell, what you think happened and who was behind 9/11. And David is saying that Bush and Cheney were certainly part of it, or certainly Cheney was, and allowed it to happen or even helped make it happen. We don't know for sure what else was there, but where are you on all of that?
Yeah, well, let's be clear that ultimately we need to have trials, and we do have a principle that has been betrayed, that people are innocent until proven guilty. And I would like to think that in the long run, we have to stand for this principle, a habeas corpus. But speculating in general terms, who had the incentive to do it, who had the means to do it, let me say that I'm looking at a letter from my university president on October the 3rd, 2016, suspending me from teaching, taking me out of the classroom, cutting my pay to zero, it's since been turned on, taking very harsh recriminatory actions. And the main allegation against me is that I did infer that Israelis, and hence Jewish individuals, were responsible for the terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center on September 11, 2001. Those are the words of my university administration. And I do take responsibility to pointing to the fact that many of the people involved in the prelude to 9/11 were in the Project for the New American Century. Many of them were dual citizens of Israel and the United States. And there is a faction within Israel and within the United States called the neocons. And the neocons have a very extravagant idea of U.S.'s future, but also Israel's future. And, of course, Israel is in a territory where they're surrounded by Muslim people, by Arab people. So 9/11, by saying that it was Islamic terrorists, largely Muslim people, acting out of zealotry, this can be pictured, and I do conceive it, as a kind of psychological operation. Essentially, the Cold War was over. The Soviet Union was no longer there, was no longer a credible enemy. The military-industrial complex needed a new enemy, and an enemy was created on September the 11th, 2001. And immediately, before the Twin Towers even fell, Ehud Barak was on BBC saying that it was Osama bin Laden, it was Al-Qaeda, that there needed to be a concerted war on terror. This is in the very first hours. This is a former prime minister of Israel. And Benjamin Netanyahu, in the Jerusalem Conference on International Terrorism in 1979, had more or less laid out, the people involved in that conference, the scenario that we're now in, the global war on terror, based on this interpretation of 9/11. Of course, 9/11 would have had to have many people involved, many interest companies that want to sell planes and bombs and all kinds of weaponry, all kinds of financial interests. But who was the directing agency? You know, I found very compelling the evidence brought forward in the military teaching apparatus of the United States by Alan Sabrowski, Dr. Alan Sabrowski, and he was very clear about the role of Israel. There is the work of Christopher Bolin and, of course, Kevin Barrett, who is very well informed on these issues and talks to everybody who has something of significance to say about new revelations on 9/11 and subsequent episodes of false flag terrorism. He takes a very clear line that it was a Zionist job, essentially a global coup d'etat. And I find that compelling. I find that the evidence does point in that direction, and to imagine that 9/11 was an attempt by zealous Islamic extremists to create a global caliphate, that they somehow got through the whole military-industrial complex system, the intelligence states with box cutters, pulled this off, nobody is fired. I mean, that really doesn't, that's an audacious interpretation. But the interpretation that since 9/11, you see what happened, and you see how, for instance, when the Israeli government talks about Palestinians and the thousands of Palestinians in dungeons and the recriminations against them and such, they're often talking about quote-unquote terrorists, and being able to label people who might have in former times be considered freedom fighters as quote-unquote terrorists and change laws and have an enormous surveillance state and you know, military invasions of largely Muslim-majority countries. When you see what happened after 9/11, it's pretty clear that the objectives of a faction within Israel, the Kudnik Israel, a faction within Zionism, not the Labor Zionist version, which were, you know, was conducting negotiations with Palestinians, land for peace, and that kind of thing. But since the Clean Break document of 1996, that has sort of been put on the side. And we have a very aggressive expansionist government in Israel with huge support in the United States and in all our Western countries. There is a strong Zionist lobby, an Israeli-centric lobby that keeps not only our governing parties very much in line with Israeli foreign policy, but also the opposition parties. We don't have much formal debate in our parliaments on our relationship with Israel. So the world changed, these massive changes that took place. Was it the United States sort of acting some sort of inside job within the United States, or was there a sort of external, strong external influence on U.S. policy? And we know that, you know, it's no secret that there is a APEC. You know, U.S. government is permeated with a lot of Israel-first influence, and that has to be interpreted as part of the new era where we don't really have respect for constitutions and human rights and bills of rights and academic freedom, for instance, that, you know, another rule is in place. And, you know, I have been suspended for talking about.
Tony, I'd like to step in here because I'm following everything you're saying. I cannot come to the same conclusions that you have. Nothing that you said is inaccurate per se. Christopher Bolin does make these claims, although I've read his book and I do not accept that Mossad was behind, or there's certainly not the evidence there that they were behind the building collapses on 9/11. However, having said that, Mossad certainly was aware that the events were going to happen. They had people across the river filming that. That's certainly the circumstantial evidence that they knew in advance that was going to happen, because their people got arrested because the local police thought they were Arabs and, you know, and the whole thing. So that became part of this initial understanding that many other intelligence agencies were aware that these events were going to happen. Certainly, the Russians were, Israel had forewarned. And in fact, Israel had forewarned the United States that these events were going to happen. So Peter Dale Scott talks about that there were probably four or five plots that were ongoing from different sources that all kind of came together on 9/11, but no single monolithic control person is evident, or are we aware of that? But you've been making these statements, and you got into serious trouble at your university around it, partly because I think you became a target because you were making these statements. So tell us what happened.
Yes. Well, just to respond a little bit before I get into that, Peter, you bring forward what you consider to be the relevant evidence, and we're having a discussion, and you disagree with me, and that is fine. That's legitimate. That's what we're supposed to do. I mean, I might respond and say, well, how do you read this report that came up from the Project for the New American Century that said, you know, there should be something like a new Pearl Harbor? Probably Wolfowitz wrote that comment. And lo and behold, a year later, there was something like a new Pearl Harbor.
Which I fully acknowledge.
Factions involved, yeah. That it's not a simple story, that there are many interests involved. And I'm choosing to talk about what I believe to be the most compelling explanation. And it's, you know, we haven't had trials. We haven't had proper investigations.
Right.
We're put in a position where we have to speculate. So last October, early October, I got a letter.
Tony Hall, I just wanted to interject one thing very quickly, that this is exactly why we need to focus on academic freedom and the rights to academic freedom and research to delve into these kinds of controversial subjects. And this is, in fact, what it's at stake here beyond you personally, is an attack on academic freedom for researching controversial topics in a nutshell. So please continue with the story of what happened last October.
In October, I got this letter. It was in midterm, saying that I was suspended. I was suspended without pay, that I would not be permitted to set foot on my campus where I taught for 27 years. I'm a tenured professor and full professor. And so if this could be done with me, who else can it be done to? The whole idea of tenure is it's supposed to protect those senior professors who've passed through the necessary filters and vetting and such to make sure they can handle this responsibly. It's to protect us so that we can address controversial issues, issues that have a lot of effect on how powerful interests negotiate their way in society. So I was suspended. Several weeks prior to that, a reprehensible Facebook item had been placed on my Facebook wall. I was not aware of it. This Facebook item had an ugly picture, and it said the Holocaust didn't happen, and it referred to Jewish people as kikes, and it said, actually, kill all Jews, every last one. A really reprehensible post. I've traced it back to, I think it might be Joshua Goldberg who created it, but in any case, I did not create it. I did not permit it to go on my Facebook wall. I wasn't even aware of it until mid-September, and by that time, an organization called B'nai B'rith Canada, an extension of the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith.
Tony Hall, let's be clear that you emphatically disagree with all of the statements from that post on your wall.
Yes, and I did condemn the reprehensible contents of that post on False Flag Weekly News in mid-September. And that was, you know, publicly broadcast, and you can watch that condemnation. It's posted online, the web show False Flag Weekly News. Nevertheless, this planted Facebook post established a momentum to a smear campaign, and then suddenly people are talking about False Flag Weekly News and, you know, my interpretations about 9/11, and I'm often on press TV. I've been to conferences in Tehran, in the Islamic Republic of Iran, and I speak on the Islamic broadcasting network, Press TV, and many of the stories that I comment on have to do with different Israeli incursions on Palestinians, on the expansion of the illegal settlements, and these kind of issues. So there's a lot online that indicates I have become a critic of Israel's treatment, the Israeli government's treatment of Palestinians, and I look at the discussion or lack of discussion in different countries, including my own Canada, and see a sort of failure of public discourse on these issues. There's a lot of paranoia around these issues. And clearly, people might look at this and say, well, it's really not a good career move to talk about some of these controversial issues. The way I looked at it as a senior professor in a Canadian university with the protections of tenure, who is going to talk about it? Who is going to deal with these issues if not somebody in my position? So I published extensively on this. I also, in Earth into Property, which is a peer-reviewed book published by an academic publisher. You know, I deal with the history of 9/11, and I bring forward my interpretation of 9/11, not as developed as it is now. So since that time, the Canadian Association of University Teachers has got involved in the matter. I was suspended outside the protections of tenure, outside the collective agreement of my University of Lethbridge. So the Faculty Association has taken up the case. It went to court for the first time on August the 8th. I have a defamation case against the president of the university and the board of governors, and we have a freedom of information investigations going forward to see how this planted Facebook post was manipulated inside the Alberta government with the premier's office and the minister of justice's offices. There was a letter coming to the president Mon of my university on September the 1st. This happened, I remind you, on August 26th. The letter said that these horrific phrases came from my lips and I should be fired. So the fact that false information was created to smear me, disinformation was created to smear me, you know, is kind of an indicator that, well, I do say controversial things. Why wasn't it enough to just point to what I actually do say? You know, Peter has taken exception with some of the things I say, and I know it's a very touchy subject, but this is what universities are for. I mean, this is where we need to have these discussions. So I invite people who may disagree with me to bring forward evidence to show why I'm wrong in my speculations or conclusions, but I don't think it is appropriate that you just suspend a person, you pull them out of the classroom, you attempt to shut them up. And Dr. Griffin was talking about bringing forward people of very spotless reputations to talk on these issues. Well, after that Facebook post and what has been stirred up, obviously this is, you know, very difficult on my reputation. It's an attempt to ruin me professionally, to take away the credibility of my voice if you know, I'm associated with such horrific slanders that have been put in my mouth. And actually an organization like the Canadian Jewish Civil Rights Association actually says these words came out of my mouth. So I have a job to do to try to change the record, you know, of course, mainstream media has reported on all of this, and I'm having a difficult time telling my side of the story. To this day, the president of the University of Lethbridge never asked me once for my side of the story. I've never talked to him about any subject. Why would he not call me into his office around September 1st, 2016, and ask me what was going on? Why did that not happen?
Tony, I need to interject quickly. Remind our listeners, I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. After our brief musical break, we'll be back to finish our interview with Dr. Anthony Hall about academic freedom surrounding issues of 9/11. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's show, for the 16th anniversary of the events of September 11, we earlier spoke with Dr. David Ray Griffin, and now we're joined by Dr. Anthony Hall. He is a professor at the University of Lethbridge and author of numerous books and articles. He is at the center of a firestorm of a controversy surrounding 9/11 and academic freedom, where he is being accused of anti-Semitic remarks that were placed on his social media walls by another individual that had nothing to do with Tony Hall. So, Tony, continue some of this narrative and what you are doing about it in terms of libel or defamation, given the facts of the case.
Well, actually, the university administration seems not to want to talk about the original Facebook post. They certainly want to talk about what we talk about on False Flag Weekly News, and they seem to want to change the subject away from how this all began on August 26th. One of the things that I'm doing in my personal capacity, I'm being represented by the faculty association at the local level and the national level, but in my personal capacity, I'm suing the president of the university, Mike Mann, and the board of governors, and I'm particularly focusing on public statements, one of which was made by Dr. Mann October 14, 2016, trying to explain this to what he called the university community. And he indicated that I'm not being suspended because of my teaching, because of my research, because of my publications. It has to do with YouTube, my YouTube publications, and social media. And those social media, he goes on to say, and YouTube's, have been characterized as being anti-Semitic, supportive of Holocaust denial, and conspiracy theories. And, of course, these are weaponized terms. You don't want to be called anti-Semitic. You don't want to be called a conspiracy theorist. You don't want to be called a Holocaust denier. He says that there was no influence from outside agencies, outside political lobbies. And yet he says that my work on social media and YouTube has been characterized as anti-Semitic, supportive of Holocaust denial, and conspiracy theory. So who is doing this characterizing? He says some external agency is characterizing me in such a way, and yet he's saying no external agencies are involved. And of course, the takeover of a university administration and the takeover of curriculum and academic matters and teaching staffing and all those kind of issues, if outside political lobbies of any sort can simply interject themselves into the governance of universities, you know, that's a very terrible precedent. And certainly the B'nai B'rith Canada, who publicized the Facebook operation, they went on to say, you know, I should be investigated, they had a petition, I should be fired, essentially I should be burned at the stake as some kind of heretic. So the idea that universities give themselves over to outside influences, political lobbies, very powerful lobbies, this obviously is not something that we want to see happen in our universities, and yet we know it is happening. It's happening in many ways and on many fronts.
It happened here in the U.S. at the University of Colorado Boulder with Ward Churchill after 9/11 for the essay he wrote comparing people at the Trade Center to little Eichmanns, a reference to Adolf Eichmann. It was a Nazi bureaucrat. That he was part of that war machine and part of the machine of genocide, in other words. And years after he wrote it, you know, he was investigated and suspended and lost his job. And then, of course, it turned into a witch hunt about plagiarism or a bunch of other things, changing the subjects, right, which sounds somewhat similar in your case.
Yeah.
And even though he was vindicated, ultimately, at the end, he still did not get his job back.
The intervention of, could I say, the Zionist lobby into the internal affairs of university is, you know, quite widespread. Campus Watch, there's all kinds of organizations, Hillel, that intervene on campus. Many times this intervention has to do with BDS, boycotts, divestment, and sanctions. I'm targeted, among others, on a website called Canary Mission, which essentially is a blacklisting site aimed at those who support BDS, aimed at students and faculty alike. Ilani Pape is one of those on that blacklist. So, you know, David Ray Griffin, his very close colleague and friend, Richard Falk, has been targeted. Richard Falk did UN investigations into the treatment of Palestinians. His friend at Santa Barbara, William Robinson, was teaching about Palestinian issues and the human rights of Palestinian peoples, and he was targeted at the University of California in Santa Barbara, and he's written a book about it and really laid out the techniques which I see being applied on my own campus. I actually wrote an article about it preparing in the summer of 2016 when I thought the B'nai B'rith Canada seemed to be taking an unusual interest in me, and I was sort of anticipating something unfortunately was about to happen. So this issue, of course, you know, is pervasive and it's very divisive. And of course, you know, we want to be very clear that we don't want to have slurs against ethnic groups in our curriculum. We've studied power and we need to understand that 9/11, for example, is a hugely transformative event. It affected the way the 21st century is unfolding on a major levels. And David Ray Griffin has written a book about that. And so it's very important that we have on campus, in the curriculum, in our research, in our pedagogy, in our community service, we have the capacity to have a real debate about what happened on 9/11. I think there's a very broad consensus among educated people who actually can think independently that the official story of 9/11 does not conform with the evidence. It's an audacious lie, in fact, and it's really insulting to the intelligence. It speaks of a certain attitude towards the public as very uncritical and not able to think for themselves. And yet this story is perpetuated, and it's a kind of becoming like a religious fable almost. There's sort of the suggestion if you question this story, it's like heresy or something.
I agree with you that 9/11, the official story, is false. I don't have any question saying that. I've been saying that for 16 years. But, you know, there's many other pieces of all of this as we've gone through the decades. Certainly, administrations and governments don't like us saying that. And I've taken some heat on my campus for speaking out on these issues, having Stephen Jones come and give a presentation on Building 7 and things like that. But we continue to look at what's new and what's important, and we've continued to try to avoid speculation on things and say, oh, this person did it or this group did it, without adequate evidence. And in particular, but what's most concerning with me, with your story, is that someone posted this really racist post on your Facebook page, and then it's implied that you agree with it, but you didn't. I mean, I read what was there, and I just immediately knew that that was absurd, that you would have ever written anything like that. But that fact that that happened, and it gave your university president a niche to lay you off, is very concerning. As a full professor myself and Mickey, we both strongly support academic freedom and the ability to talk about these issues openly and to call it what we think when we think something's incorrect or beyond the evidence, then we'll say it. And we try to do that in a very open way.
I've tried to contact the American Association of University Professors because I think the agenda here to shut me down and make an example of me, try to ruin me professionally, this is meant to send out a signal to scare others so they don't get the courage to do what Dr. Griffin is suggesting and actually go into this issue and realize, although it may be difficult, if enough of us do it with integrity and are able to go with the evidence and have our disagreements in a proper way. The fact that the universities have not done that, that Noam Chomsky was very outspoken in terms of condemning people who would look at 9/11. We're looking at a situation where the peace movement has become kind of defunct And I think you can't have a good analysis of the wars we're in unless you understand how were these wars justified? Where did it start? It had a lot to do with what actually happened on 9/11. And if you have an incorrect view of what happened on 9/11, you're not going to have a good analysis of how the war machine is presently operating. So it's vital on many levels that we preserve the ground to have these discussions and debates. And on 9/11, we need a lot more think tanks, a lot more conferences, a lot more security for real discussions, because it's a very complex matter with many, many facets. And the whodunit story, if we had a credible explanation from officialdom of what happened, we wouldn't have to go there. But the explanation we've been given is so unlikely, is so far removed from what the evidence tells us, that of course we're going to speculate. And to expect that there are honest parties left when the media is this committed to back up a certain narrative, how could they back off that position at this late date? The cover-up has become the biggest part of the crime, in my view. And who is leading the cover-up? And where do you see the center of gravity? And I have to say that over the years, I've noticed that Israel First partisans tend to be the most vociferous critics of anybody looking at 9/11, whether they're looking at an Israeli connection or not, even if they're just talking about Building 7. Who is pushing back and defending the official story? So that's part of my thinking. Anyway, I appreciate this ability to talk openly with you, and I congratulate you at Project Censored for really, in a way, pioneering a discussion on this matter, because it's been kind of lonely and frustrating to not be able to speak to a broader audience about the serious things I'm seeing happening around me.
Well, Tony Hall, we appreciate you coming on the program. We certainly are proponents of academic freedom. We think it's important that when academic freedom is at stake with individuals, whether they're agreed with or not by other parties, it's really important to stand up for the principles of academic freedom. We know that's what you're doing right now at the center of your struggle. So, Tony Hall, thanks so much for joining us on the Project Censored show today. We'd like to remind our local listeners that the 9/11 Film Festival is at Grand Lake Theater in Oakland. That's Monday, September 11th, between 3 and 10. Tony Hall will be speaking there with William Pepper and others. Tony Hall, thanks again for speaking with us on the Project Censored show.
And you'll be speaking there, Mickey. I'm looking forward to seeing you there.
Indeed. Thanks again.
Okay. Cheerio.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign.
This is the Project Censored Show. We air on roughly 40 stations around the U.S. from Maui to New York. Peter Phillips and I are executive producers and co-hosts. Anthony Fest is our producer, Erica Bridgman, our engineer. To learn more about Project Censored and our parent nonprofit Media Freedom Foundation, go to projectcensored.org. To hear past programs and special Project Censored podcasts with our associate co-hosts, Nolan Higdon, Nick Bayham, and Desiree McSwain, go to the Project Censored page /radio. Click on our podcast and Patreon page. Follow and like us on Facebook and Twitter. We'll see you next time. Up next, Terra Verde.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. John Trudell at a benefit for the UWA of Colombia.
Memories of that benefit in March 2001 came rushing back in the summer of 2017. Amazon Watch announced the good news. UWA are returning to their ancestral land from which they had been expelled. In July, 10 UWA families packed up their belongings and returned to the hamlet known as Rio Negro. The region had been a salt mining site. If all goes according to plan, in the next 6 months, another 50 or so families will resettle in the area. Amazon Watch is proudly supporting their return with funds for everyday necessities, like soup pots, mosquito nets, and farming tools. The families are reclaiming a part of their ancestral territory that the Uwa hope to incorporate into a new reservation, the Guanuwa Rauri Uwa Reservation. Territorial recovery, defense, and even legal recognition from the government are important for indigenous communities in Colombia and around the globe. They are all threatened by dirty energy projects, large-scale dams, roads, mining, and deforestation. The Uwa live in the remote Andes of northeastern Colombia, along the border with Venezuela. This rebroadcast of one of TUC Radio's most popular programs is both a shout-out to the Uwa and their journey home, and a tribute to John Tudell, who spoke at the 2001 fundraiser for them. He died on December 8, 2015. And in a prior edition of the program, this is what I said about him. Tudell grew up on and around the Santa Sioux Reservation near Omaha, Nebraska. In 1969, he participated in the Indians of All Tribes occupation of Alcatraz Island. From 1973 to 1979, he served as national chairman of AIM, the American Indian Movement. The government response to AIM was swift, Tudell said. They waged war against us. They hunted us down. They killed, jailed, and destroyed us by any means necessary. One of AIM's greatest accomplishments on Tudell's watch was drawing attention to the U.S. government policy of tribal termination and the eventual rollback of termination and the restoration of tribal rights and some native lands. AIM walked the longest walk from California to D.C. and occupied the Bureau of Indian Affairs headquarters building. While there, AIM activists went through the files and discovered secret plans to terminate even more tribes. John Tudell personally became a target of the FBI in their amazing 17,000-page dossier on him. They reported that they feared his verbal skills the most. You are about to hear the first half hour of a talk he gave in March 2001 in San Francisco. The hall was filled to capacity. Tudell took the stage with a thin folder of his poems under his arm. He began with a disclaimer of sorts, leading into a free association of thoughts about earth and sun, ancient wisdom and modern intelligence, and what it means to be a human being. Here is John Tudell.
Well, I'll try to be coherent. And I don't know exactly where we're going, but wherever it is, we'll be okay. But if I say anything that you don't agree with, that's just really what it is, right? Because I really am crazy, right? So, really. I flew with the eagles until I fell from the nest. I ran with the wolves, then got lost from the pack. Slowly I go crazy every day. Some days run faster than others. I never strayed into heaven. It was hard getting past hell. I traveled through and beyond the death and birth of man. I am Iktomi. Imagine running out of imagine. Mistaking authority for power, weaving life's free spirit into patterns of control. I heard all that was said. Until now, I hear nothing at all. The edge between twilight and dark, the great lie lurks. Prostitution of soul, anyone can do it or not. I went down some roads that stopped me dead in my tracks. I am Iktomi. I've been the mirror to others reflecting selves. I've known love that can't help but love. And I've been close to that hurting way of love. I flew with the eagles until I fell from the nest. I ran with the wolves, then got lost from the pack. From the earth, wind cave memories. One with the sky, time of different motions. Dog days dreamer, chasing the neon woven into minds. From my place in line, I fell out of order. I've been here, I've been there, I've been anywhere, and I haven't been anywhere. And I'll be back again. I am Iktomi. Imagine running out of imagine, mistaking authority for power, weaving life's free spirit into patterns of control. In the reality of many realities, how we see what we see affects the quality of our reality. We are children of earth and sky, DNA, descendant, now ancestor, human being, physical spirit, bone, flesh, blood as spirit, metal, mineral, water as spirit. We are in time and space, but we're from beyond time and space. The past is part of the present. The future is part of the present. Life and being are interwoven. We are the DNA of Earth, Moon, planets, stars. We are related to the universal. Creator created creation, spirit and intelligence with clarity. Being and human as power. We are a part of the memories of evolution. These memories carry knowledge. These memories carry our identity. Beneath race, gender, class, age, beneath citizen, business, state, religion, we are human beings. And these memories are trying to remind us, human beings, human beings, it's time to rise up. Remember who we are. I think I want to talk a little bit about who we are. Because, see, reality is based upon our perception of reality. It's what it is. But we really need to understand that. See, and I think one of the objectives in life is to understand. It's not enough to know. Right? I know how to turn on the TV, but I can't even begin to understand how it works. So it's not enough to know. So I think one of the purposes that life teaches us is the further we make it into life, is the more coherency we have left than we will understand. Sometimes I feel like I'm in a reality where I'm surrounded by all these beings that don't know who they are. They don't know who they are. And because they don't know who they are, they don't know where they are. They don't understand the language that they speak. So there's a general confusion and chaos that just takes place in their reality. It's almost like, you know, the way they make all the little chaos go inside of an internal combustion engine, you know, and all the sparks and all the stuff just flying in, and it creates an energy that runs something. Well, anyway, it's almost like this is the perceptional reality that is being carried around in the human consciousness. So anyway, who we are, we're human beings. And the DNA of the human being, our bone, flesh, and blood is literally made up of the metals, minerals, and liquids of the earth. We are literally shapes and forms of the earth. That's who we are. And we have being. Our being comes from our relationship to the sun and to the universe. Because our relationship to the sun, let's be very coherent and clear about this. Without the sun, we would not have life. All right, it's almost like the rays of light that the sun represents and brings to the earth. See, this is the sperm that gives life to the womb that earth is. So our relationship to power and our relationship to the reality of power is connected to that relationship. Anyway, what I see, the human, the being part of human is being mined through the human experience. They're mining us. And whoever they are, I don't have the names, but we'll just figure some of that out on our own because, you know, and I'm sure they have names. I'm real sure that they do, but they don't. But I can't say them to you because they don't want us to know their names, maybe, right? Because what they're doing isn't really, you know, in a way it's like vampirism and a lot of things. But anyway, in a mechanical term, we're being mined. And the being part of human is being mined through the logic of the human, right? And the emotions of the human. The being of spirit, the spirit of being, is what is being mined through the logics and emotions of the human in order to run the systems. I mean, this is the purpose of technologic civilization. They call it technologic for a very specific reason. This isn't an accident, okay? You know? It truly isn't. But the purpose of the civilization, and so one of the civilizing processes is to erase memories. Right? To erase memories. Because we have ancestral memory. It's encoded in the DNA. It's a genetic memory. You look at how technologic civilization, and everywhere that it goes, the longer it's there, the more isolated the human beings, but they're not called human beings, they're workers and citizens and et cetera, right? Right? But the more isolated they feel, they no longer, you know, maybe they remember their grandparents or their great-grandparents. But see, you've got all that ancestral knowledge that's encoded in the DNA, but it's been cut off. So it can't activate, because if we're not conscious that it's there, then it just makes it difficult. See, this is a memory that is very important for them to erase. All right? And it's about who we are. It's a memory of identity and self-reality. So anyway, we come from where we come from. Every one of us is the descendant of a tribe. Every person in this room is a descendant of a tribe at some point in our ancestral evolution. Common collective genetic memory that's in there, you know, that's encoded, like I say, in the DNA. And for every individual, encoded in our individual DNA, all right, is the experience of our lineage from the very beginning, whose whole perceptual reality was what I was just saying. All things have being. We're made up of the earth. All my relations pray to spirits. See, and they didn't pray to man or human form. The closest they came to it was they prayed to spirits that were called ancestors. Right? And because they were praying those ancestors for help and guidance, they understood that we were borrowing today from the past and the future. We're borrowing it from both places. They had this understanding of reality, so they knew that to keep the balance was the purpose. That was the purpose. The reason for being was to keep the balance. So this was like, you know, what I will call a spiritual perception of reality. And so because of the spiritual perception of reality, they understood that life was about responsibility. It wasn't about the abstraction of freedom. It was about responsibility. That life was about responsibility. So the spiritual perception of reality was based upon that. We were the children of the earth. The earth was our mother. The sky, the sun and the sky, these were our fathers, right? But this was, and our reality worked for us. This morning, the mirror didn't know who I was today. I remember some of the whatever happened to's. Then sometimes I'm too occasional to understand or comprehend. What I believed was because I was delusional. There's no other explanation. Clinging to the program, obviously, is the obvious lie. The past is more than a memory. Experiencing the future before the fantasy was the dream. Fantasy is the leftovers, a toxic waste from mining the dream. It's a perceptional thing. This technologic mental state, is this reality or more desperate lies? Manufacturing perceptions, packaging free thinking into reacted thought. Sometimes when it rains, it's not that simple when the sky has reasons to cry. This evening, the mirror saw that I looked kind of familiar tonight. In our common collective genetic ancestral mind, not a one of our ancestors went for the new show. Nobody wanted, they wouldn't buy the tickets. So the show was going to die. So the show decided rather than it die, it would make our ancestors die until they accepted the show. And this is what happened. And it happened to all of us. Whatever happened to the Indians here, trust me, it happened to the tribes of Europe. You know, it started happening to them 3,000 years before it happened to us. So by the time the descendants of tribes of Europe got here, they had it down. You know, they were very efficient. They could do in a couple hundred years what it took. I mean, no offense. Moths and other sacred wings. Butterflies and bees whisper. In breath of the wind, blessed way, blessing way things. Dreams are the mind's streams, thought pictures of the spirit. There are dreams of the day. There are dreams of the night. Thinking and dreaming are related. Dreams of the day we make our own. Dreams of night, part of eternal stone. There are dream takers, taking from dream worlds, taking dreams as a way of stealing thoughts, turning minds inside and out. Dream slavers want to change our connections to ourselves, mess with our dreams, make us unsure, unclear about right and wrong, feed our dreams and instincts to industrial profit machine. Difference between dream and fantasy, reality and illusion, center and no center. Dreams of the day keep our spirit alive, our creative mind, who we really are. With dreams, we can create and heal, follow our original purpose. Dreams are protection, good medicine. Blessed way things. Sun and moon continue. We are all on one journey. So in our collective genetic ancestral memory, we had the experience of encountering the technologic perceptual reality. Because somewhere as this thing unfolded and refined itself as it was spreading over the planet, a religious perceptual reality was used to replace a spiritual perceptual reality. All right? Because the spiritual sense of reality, you're connected to everything, man. You know, you're connected. But in the religious perceptual reality, see, you committed a crime for being born. See, you're forgetting here. Yeah, I didn't make this up. I'm not making it up now. Right? And so anyway, in order to justify being here, to get to stay, right, you had to submit to the male dominator chain of command, the authoritarian system. In this new religious reality said that, you know, well, now there's one God. The gods battle it out amongst themselves, see. See, I can't envision, to me, I've never been able to envision gods or goddesses. I can't imagine a creator in a human form. I can't. And I think our path to trouble started when we started to do it that way. All right, looking at the earth as the mother and these things, you know, call her the goddess, whatever, and this and that. See, but I don't go with God because I know that's a limited perceptual reality. See, they forced it on us, but the trouble came. See, when we decided that the creator entity had a human form. See, because then that rationalized and justified mistreating the rest of the natural world. All right, I mean, sexism and racism came out of this perceptual change because once the earth, you know, under the new God thing, see, the earth was no longer the mother. The earth was the property, this new God, and all God's children. See, God didn't have a lot then, but they were very mean, so their numbers expanded through terror. See, but God's children, was their job and objective was to subdue the earth for this God. So in order to achieve that objective, they had to create sexism. See, sexism's got to do with how we live with the earth. And racism, because now the earth was property, you know, and all spiritual value was away from the earth, you know. Real spiritual value was now a religious perceptual thing, and right, so it wasn't all-encompassing. It wasn't just a part of the reality anymore. So not a one of our people really went for this. Because it's like, you know, this is a major perceptual reality change. But anyway, we committed a moral crime for getting here, so now we had to submit to that worldview. To me, coherently to me, it's clearly a very blatant perceptual altering how one perceives reality. I mean, it's brainwashing intensified at its maximum, right? because our ancestors were forced to see life differently in order to remain just physically alive. All right, you know, it's like, I don't really know that much about what happened to Europe, but I would suggest every person of European descendancy that you go and you study. You want to know more about your reality? Go and study your tribal ancestry and see how you got civilized. All right? See how you got civilized. Because terrible things happened. And these terrible things, these are what altered the perceptional reality. See, and because the basic part of this, and that altering of the perceptional reality, what we're getting down to is it made us become irresponsible as human beings. Because, see, we can blame the bad guys for being bad guys, but that don't work. It's not enough. It's about human beings remembering their spiritual reality, their spiritual identity, and accepting the responsibility from that perceptional reality, taking responsibility. Because the bad guys only get away with what they get away with because we don't take responsibility. Because there's a difference between blaming somebody for something and taking responsibility. So when Columbus got here, he got off the boat and he said to the first people he saw, "Who are you?" And the first people he saw said, "We're human beings." And Columbus said, "Oh, Indians." And right now when I'm talking, Columbus is every descendant of the tribe of Europe that came. We're not talking one person here. We're talking a mindset. All right, this is a mentality that came, the Columbus mentality, we name it. Right? Because, but it's about discovering. This is, you know, it's like almost like this is when the virus got here. And this is how long it's been here. But because, you know, we've never had this disease before, that we have no natural, we don't have an immunity to it. But if we can survive the ravages of this disease, we will evolve an immunity to it because we are the part of the earth, and that's what happens. Right? Anyway, Columbus got here. And he didn't know what it meant to be a human being. See, that perceptional reality of being a human being and what it really meant had been erased from descendants of the tribes of Europe by the time they got here. So when we introduced ourselves to the European as human beings, they just didn't get it. It wasn't a part of their perceptional reality. They might know how to say the words, right? But being a human being had changed in their reality, right? We know there was an Inquisition. And this Inquisition went on for 400 or 500 years in Europe. The purpose of the Inquisition was to alter the perceptional reality of the descendants of the tribes of Europe, to make them believe and see reality the way the church wanted them to believe and see reality. The church called it, they waged a war for possession, This is important. They waged a war for the possession of the souls of the godless heathens. And to be a godless heathen, you just didn't believe in God. It wasn't part of your reality. Or another way of becoming a godless heathen was to question the authority of the church to do this. You know, again, I'm not making this up. You know, this did transpire. These things did happen. And they killed as many people as they could, I guarantee it, in order to get the other ones to submit. So they killed as efficiently as they could with the technology they had at their disposal at that time, all right? And because they created a rationalization as to why to do it, so it just became as efficient as they could do. And at some point, the descendants of the tribes of Europe no longer knew what it meant to be a human being. They just didn't know. They didn't want to know. So the descendants of the tribes of Europe, in the end, had to love what they feared, which was there to possess them. See, and I think it messed up love in a lot of ways, you know, that they haven't unsorted yet. No offense, but... But anyway, all of this took place through our intelligence. Our intelligence. Now, whoever it is we pray to, right? Whoever it is we pray to, however we pray, all right? I think that we have an obligation and a responsibility, and it's about respect. If we respect our Creator, then we should use our intelligence as intelligently as we can, as often as we can. And that means with clarity and coherency. That means to activate and respect our intelligence and activate the thinking process so that it's going the way we want it to be because that's why it was given to us. our intelligence as the human being part of all of this reality that's going on. We were given intelligence. This is what was there to help us through the evolutionary reality, to ride the balance, so to speak, of the evolution with our intelligence. It's our medicine. It's our protection. It's our self-defense. Those fears and doubts and insecurity in one's daily mind and reality, how much do they affect one's daily mind and reality? How much do they affect the ones of the people around them that they're connected to and cared about, that they care about? So what's the repercussions of the fears and the doubts and insecurity? Because I guarantee you, every day when we get up, we use our intelligence to create those effects. So it isn't that we're not using our intelligence or we can't use our intelligence. We can't stop using our intelligence. But it's about, as human beings, taking the responsibility to be as clear as one possibly can be about it and use our intelligence the way our Creator gave it to us to use. Keep the balance. Our intelligence. So this is everything that ever happened. Had to change the perceptual reality, the battleground had to take place. The real battleground may have been the bleeding and the dying, but it has to do with the intelligence. To alter the perceptual reality. So again, about respect. See, if we respect our Creator, we have a responsibility to recognize our intelligence and use it as clearly and coherently as we possibly can. Otherwise, we're just pretending. We're just being delusional and rationalizing and justifying and just telling ourselves a big lie. If we do not use our intelligence as intelligently as we possibly can, that's how we show respect to our Creator. See, and you can't say you don't know because I just told it to you. Right? So, I mean,
that was the first half hour of a one-hour talk by the Native American poet, musician, and activist John Trudell. John Trudell died age 69 on December 8, 2015. He spoke in March 2001 at a benefit for the UWA of Colombia. Come back for the second part of this speech when TUC Radio returns. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.
Latin Waves with your hosts Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
So the goal, you see, of indigenous education, as was reflected in the poem, was to find your face, find your heart, find your foundation in these relationships and responsibilities, concentric relationships and responsibilities, towards the goal of becoming a complete human being.
That's the voice of renowned indigenous author, Dr. Gregory Cayette. On this week's show, we speak to Dr. Cayette about his philosophy on indigenous education and society. Dr. Cayette is a publisher of many books, including Look to the Mountain and Ecology of Indigenous Education. So stay tuned.
I have the great privilege of having this morning the author of Look to the Mountain, an Ecology of Indigenous Education, Dr. Gregory Cayette.
Look to the Mountain is a wonderful book that offers not just educators, but people in general, a remarkable fresh perspective on the challenges facing education in contemporary society. Dr. Kayet is a member of the Tewa Peoples from New Mexico. Very privileged to have you on our program.
Thank you very much. I'm really very happy and very honored to have some time to share my thoughts with you.
Now, you've written about an ecology of indigenous education. Tell us what inspired you to write this book. What is the hope in writing this book?
Primarily, it's a book that is, I guess you might say, a product of both, I would say, creative anger would be one way to describe, one emotion that went into writing this book. I work at that time at a school called the Institute of American Indian Arts in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And the school basically is a Bureau of Indian Affairs school. It's one of three post-secondary schools. And in this case, the Institute of American Indian Arts is dedicated to using the arts primarily as a foundation for training young aspiring Native people in the vocation of art in a variety of areas. So it's it of its very nature was a very early on a kind of leader in culturally based arts education. So I was a teacher there. I'm also a self-taught artist, and during that time I was really the school was involved or embroiled, as will happen with many issues related to its literally its existence. And at that time, it was being slated to be closed. And we had gone through a major effort through the Congress, because the school actually is a line item within the federal budget. It's a federally chartered school, one of just a few in the country. And we were being slated to be basically erased from the budget, and so it was a very traumatic time. We had come out of that. They had allowed the school to remain open and reorganized it. It had to change in a very significant way from being an indigenous school to being a school that reflected essentially the Western idea or concept of education. And of course, many of us teaching at the school at that time were very passionate and committed to the school and to the idea of creating an indigenous school around indigenous arts. And so we felt that we had been in a sense compromised in a very significant way with the new legislation. So even though we did remain open, and and the institute is still open today and getting lots and lots of money from various sources, it lost something during that time. And so it was a passion that then led me to begin to write, what is the ecology of indigenous education? I had been working on what is called a culturally relevant or culturally based science education curriculum, which I had introduced at the school at that time, which integrated science with art, with the cultural perspectives of the students coming from throughout the United States, to the school too. So based on that, also I had to go into really answering the question, what is indigenous education, or what is education for indigenous people? How did we practice this process of education in pre-Columbian times? What was our epistemology, if you will, of education? So that's what led me essentially to explore, to research, and to write the book, Look to the Mountain. So that's kind of, brief, the story of how I wrote it. Let me just finish by saying that the term Look to the Mountain is actually it's an English translation of a Tewa metaphor. We're surrounded by four sacred mountains here in New Mexico, where I live, and in my village, which is Santa Clara Pueblo, which is one of six Tewa-speaking pueblos north of Santa Fe. We have various sacred mountains, you know, that sort of encompass or sort of bound, you know, our territory. And so elders will sometimes come up, and especially as we're discussing different kinds of issues that affect the community as a whole, I remember some elders using the term look to the mountain, you know, which is basically telling the people, look to your history, you know, where you come from, because you, as you climb a mountain, you go through a process of going through the foothills and climbing to the top of the mountain. And then when you're on top of the mountain, you have another perspective, which is your present. And then as you look out from the top of the mountain, you know, to the other mountains and other valleys around you, you have a vision of possibilities of where to go next. So it's past, present, and future coming together in that act of journeying, you know, to the mountain. And so it's a way of understanding perspective about what you are discussing or what you're reflecting on. And so I use that metaphor, you know, very specifically to reflect on what is Indigenous education, what does that mean, what did that mean to us in the past, what does it mean to us in the present, and what are the possibilities, what is the vision of Indigenous education for the future. And so that's basically look to the mountain, and that's the metaphor that I used.
That's a beautiful metaphor. I just want to borrow on something you mentioned, and that is that creative anger, because in your book you speak about mythopoetic, and I want to talk about the myths. You know, there are myths in our society that not only create how we see the world, but how we engage in the world. And one has been that education is a neutral force, and it takes that stance in relation to colonization. It takes the stance that colonization is something that happened long ago, and it's, you know, we're in a post-colonial society now. So I want to speak about, from a perspective of the Maya people, the Aymara people, the Ojibwe, Haida, the Tewan people, to me it seems that process continues today. I wonder, could you talk about what has been the legacy of education in the colonization process, and what stories of this sad history must be remembered today?
Well, I have to say emphatically that education is not neutral, nor has it ever been neutral, especially in terms of the way it has been practiced and applied within Western cultural settings. Very definitely, education was a tool of colonization, and really continues to be that in some ways today. I think that one of the struggles that Native people have as a whole has been, you know, to in a sense, endure, if you will, Western education, to find ways to adapt to it without losing themselves. And it's been a very long and tenuous history that Native people have had with education as a whole. And so we're just really, really within this past 50, 60 years have begun to just very much a step-by-step process, regain control or at least some control of our education and also of our process of education. So it's been a long journey. In really just being self-determined and really applying that concept of self-determination to education. But yes, definitely education has never been, for Native people at least, neutral.
So I think of the stories that frame that discussion, though, and where are our stories? What are the stories that we must be remembering and retelling?
Well, in the book, Look to the Mountain, I you know, as I researched this question, what is Indigenous education? And of course, you know, the philosophical term that is used for this process of learning culturally is epistemology, which is a fancy philosophical term, but basically it means how do you come to know what you know? How do you come to know what you know? And so you see, every cultural, human cultural group has had a philosophy, a vision, if you will, an understanding of how they collectively come to know what they know, which is the epistemology. So, for example, in order to create the kinds of curriculum that I was creating at the Institute at that time, I had to understand, first of all, you know, what is our own history of indigenous education? What is our epistemology? Because unless you understand that, you don't really have a truly culturally based or culturally relevant curriculum that you can begin to build from. So as I was looking, you know, really looking and researching all over the world and trying to find some kind of a handle, if you will, you know, that I could use a story or a case that sort of exemplify what indigenous epistemology was, I happened on a very old work that was being done in the early 60s by a gentleman whose name is Miguel Leon Portillo. And he worked, I believe, out of the University of Texas, Austin. And he wrote a book in the 1960s called Aztec Thought and Culture. And in that, he was exploring, you know, what the Aztecs believed education was. And so there's a poem in there, you know, because he was using basically translations from Nahuatl to Spanish into English and looking at different kinds of remnants of poems, you know, that had survived the burning of the libraries in Mexico City at that time. And he found a poem that sort of, and he characterized it in this way. He said, you know, there was a professor, you know, in one of the colleges, the universities, if you will, of the Aztec. And the question was to the students, the professor's question to the students was, what is it to be a person of knowledge? And the students, and again, all of this is chanted, you see, very much like the Hawaiians and the Maoris, the discourse was chanted, you know, in these ritual poems and ritual prayers. And so the chant was given, what is it to be a person of knowledge? The students go off and come back maybe a few days later, and they have a responsal chant that is basically in a poetic form. And that's what these poems that Miguel Leon Portillo was studying. And so in the chant from the students back to the professor, they said this, first one must find one's face. One must find one's face, which in our terms today means you have to have a sense of your identity. Then they said one must find one's heart, which is really, in today's education jargon, the affective domain. You have to have a sense of why you're doing something. But it goes much deeper. You know, finding a heart is really also about finding your own sense of spirit. And then one must find one's foundation. Foundation to stand on, which allows you to most completely reflect your heart and your face. And so foundation in our terms today would be vocation, you know, that kind of work that you would do that would allow you, in a sense, to be completely expressive of who you are as a person. And then that all of that happened in these contexts of relationships and responsibilities, concentric rings of relationship and responsibility. First, yourself to yourself, yourself to your family, yourself to your clan, yourself to your tribe, yourself to the place from which you come, and then finally, yourself to the whole cosmos. And then they said it was towards becoming a complete person, a complete man or woman. So the goal, you see, of indigenous education, as was reflected in the poem, was to find your face, find your heart, find your foundation in these relationships and responsibilities, concentric relationships and responsibilities, towards the goal of becoming a complete human being. And so when I found that, I said, this is the essence of indigenous epistemology, you know, because as you will discover as you study this among different tribes, they have different ways of saying basically the same thing, you know, that one must know oneself, one must have a sense of your spirit or your desire, one has to have foundation that's rooted in a community of relationship and responsibility. and that there's a spiritual aspect that guides you as much as an intellectual, you know, towards this journey, if you will, to the top of the mountain. And so that, I think, really epitomizes for me what Indigenous education is. And so knowing that and understanding that, we can then, in a sense, begin to build some, in a sense, in a contemporary education setting, some kinds of curriculum that begin to bring some of these values, these core values, these core orientations out again among students. And you can use different subject areas to do this, of course. And you know, and before I was at the Institute of American Indian Arts, I was a field biologist. So my area is science, but I'm also an artist. I'm also an Indigenous person. So what I started to do was create curriculum that integrated these different aspects of myself, which I know was also true of my students, and bring them together in kind of a cohesive learning map, learning process, which we call curriculum. And so, that's basically that story, that part of the story.
I love that story, but because I think that so much of our world is in pain today, and primarily because of this fragmentation of who we are. You know, our bodies have become just a vehicle that carries our head, one of my professors said. And, you know, we live totally disconnected, not only to ourselves, but also to the people around us. And that, you know, this connection also leads to a distancing of the suffering of others. So our world is in need of healing. In your book, you speak of healing. We live in a world with deep scars where one needs only to look around to see the suffering of war, the result of war, hunger, chronic unemployment. Can we heal a world without first acknowledging the nature of this wound?
Well, definitely, you know, colonization wounds people very deeply and through generations. And so in many ways, what has been happening these past few years, you know, has been a kind of recognition that we are and have been traumatized by colonization, an understanding of that process. And I think that we're finally beginning to now move forward into a new phase of thinking about ourselves in a very different kind of way than we were conditioned to with regard to our own colonization. And so, you know, in earlier days with the boarding school, with the ways in which Native kids were indoctrinated within schools, to forget their culture, forget their language, to forget their history even. And for a period, and also for several generations of Native people, that was their experience of education. We've now, I think, turned a corner, especially with in 1974, there was an act called the Indian Self-Determination Act, in which Native people were given the right, in a sense, to create their own schools and also to create their own forms of education, you know. And so that then gave the impetus for many Native educators to begin to think about what and how we could actually create a different way of educating ourselves and our students in a way that honored their history, honored their language, honored their traditions, honored their communities. And so that's been a struggle. It's been a long journey. It's still a journey that continues in a variety of different kinds of ways. I call it, at this point in time, the Indigenous mind rising. Because what I see as I go around all over the world, basically, and work with Indigenous populations around education as a whole or science education, I'm beginning to see that many Indigenous peoples, many Indigenous cultures are moving towards, in a sense, you know, honoring their past, really recreating or revitalizing their language and their communities, and then also bringing forward education as a tool, not only of decolonizing themselves, but actually making education Indigenous once again. And so I think that that's the vision for the future, is the sense that as this process evolves through time among Indigenous populations and people that this is really the goal that indigenous people have for themselves. It's more than, you know, getting a job and fitting into the system, because that was also a phase of Native education. But I think now it's moving, you know, towards this deeper reclaiming and recreating of our indigenous identity, indigenous heritage, you know, through the process of education. And so I know that indigenous scholars, you know, wherever you find them in the world, are very, very much involved with this kind of enterprise these days. So that's my hope, is that, that's the healing of the wound. And it's not only the healing of the wound, but it now, in a sense, is moving into a phase of revitalization and recreation of indigenous culture in a contemporary setting in ways that are appropriate and ways that make sense, but also a renewal, I guess you might say, of indigenous spirituality, indigenous economics, indigenous community, indigenous forms of education, so that we have, in a sense, a way to once again survive and actually even to thrive. Now, of course, you know, the world is in such chaos these days, and so, you know, we have climate change, we have wars, we have poverty, we have, you know, the struggle of economics, if you will. But I still, within that context, the indigenous mind is rising, and I think that especially in the areas of ecology and ecological philosophy, I think that many of the new ecological academics have paid heed and are beginning to build on indigenous-like concepts, you know, within within education and also within within the ecological movement. So I see a lot of hope, you know, at least in that context. But again, indigenous people have to do a lot of the work for themselves if they are also going to be a part of that broader global movement, I guess you might say.
Thank you so much for being with us. We're coming to the end of the interview, but I wonder if you could just leave us with some words of inspiration. What inspires you to continue to struggle against what you just described, all this chaos that surrounds us? What inspires your hope that we can, you know, create a different story? What should that new story of who we can become?
Well, I think, you know, education in its best sense always has to be about visions of a brighter future. And so my hope, you know, in the work that I do, I am a director of Native American Studies at the University of New Mexico, and I've been in that position for 10 years. And so what I'm doing with the students that I'm working with in our degree program is helping them think about, you know, that sense of who we are, our history, have them understand, you know, the issues in a very deep and using research in a way, helping them to understand their present situation. But finally, having them create a context in which they can use that kind of education for engaging a vision of the future. And that vision of the future, I think, really needs to be about a reclaiming of indigenous values globally with regard to how we interact with each other, which is one kind of ecology. It's social ecology in more harmonious and more self-supporting ways or mutually supporting ways. How we engage with our natural environment in a more supportive and ecologically sound way, and how we engage with ourselves spiritually, because I think there's also, you know, part of this issue of the modern dilemma or the in terms of modernity and also the issues of capitalism. As kind of the underpinning of that modernity, is that we have to begin to create new ways of understanding how we interact with each other around, how we develop our forms of economic, our forms of education, our forms of community. So right now I'm really, exploring in my next book. I've written 6 books, but the 7th book is going to be about pedagogy of indigenous community, very much like Look to the Mountain in some ways. But to take a look at ways in which we begin to work with each other in more harmonious and more direct ways, applying indigenous principles from the past, applying the best ideas from the present, and really beginning to forge a different kind of future for our children and for our communities. So my hope is that education can actually become a tool not for indoctrination and for assimilation as it was used in the past for indigenous people, but a tool for transformation and for, truly becoming and finding your face and finding your heart and truly becoming complete human beings once again.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much for being with us. How can people access your books?
I can be reached at G Cajete, and that's just GCAJETE, @AOL.com.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much for being with us and for taking the time to talk with us.
Okay, thank you, Sylvia. Have a great day.
That was Dr. Gregory Cajete. He is the director of the Native American Studies. He's also an author, and his book, Look to the Mountain, is a fantastic and highly recommended book for anyone looking to create transformative change in education or in our communities. We have come to the end of our program. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program available to campus and community radios. Please visit our website, www.latinwavesmedia.com, to hear previous shows, connect to our media projects, and access other resources, or to support our efforts by making a safe PayPal contribution. I am Sylvia Richardson. Thanks for listening.